Good morning, everybody, again. Are we live yet? We are. So I want to welcome you all to the Rare Disease Advisory Panel meeting. I want to make note, as always when we meet, that the webinar is open to the public and is being recorded. Those of you that are members of the public are invited to listen to this teleconference and view the webinar. You may submit comments. We welcome comments through the webinar chat function or by emailing advisorypanels@pcori.org. We also invite you to visit www.pcori.org/events for more information. Okay. Marshall Sumner, the chair of the advisory panel on rare diseases, will read a statement on confidentiality.
Actually, conflict of interest.
Conflict of interest.
Yeah. I sort of feel like I'm reading the benediction to begin us out with. Our COI statement, welcome to the advisory panel on rare disease meeting. I want to remind everyone that disclosures of conflicts of interest of members of the advisory panel on rare disease are publicly available on PCORI's website. Members of the advisory panel on rare disease are reminded to update your conflict of interest disclosures if the information has changed. In addition to completing your annual disclosure, you can do this by contacting your staff representative. Finally, the advisory panel on rare disease will deliberate or take action on a matter that presents a conflict of interest for you. Please inform the chair, that'd be me, so we can discuss how to address the issue.
Thank you, Marshall. So why don't we go around and introduce ourselves? I know that we have done that internally and informally. But for the purposes of those that may be listening in. So I am Brian Luce. I'm the Chief Science Officer here at PCORI.
I'm Marshall Sumner, Chief of Genetics and Metabolism at Children's National and the panel chair.
Thank you. And please all use your mic.
Naomi Aronson, Executive Director for Clinical Evaluation, Innovation, and Policy at Blue Cross and Blue Shield Association, and a Methodology Committee member of the Court.
And also, please, each one of you, identify whether you're on the panel. Most of you are, but some of you are not. So.
Russell Teagarden, I'm independent at the moment, and I'm on the rare disease panel.
I'm Marilyn Bull. I'm on the panel, and I'm a neurodevelopmental pediatrician geneticist from Indiana University Riley Hospital for Children.
I'm Marty Gomberg Maitland. I'm on the panel. I'm a cardiologist, director of the pulmonary hypertension program at the University of Chicago.
Jim Wu, I'm on the panel, and I'm a health economist with Amgen.
Hi, this is Laura Forsyth. I'm on the PCORI staff with our research integration and evaluation program.
Hi, I'm Vadim Gershti, and I'm also on the PCORI staff with the RIE program as well.
Good morning. Mark Skinner, panel member, patient advocate from the bleeding disorders community.
Good morning. I am Yaffa Rubinstein on the panel as well, and I'm leading the Global Rare Disease Patient Registry Data Repository and the biospecimen database, NIH and CATS.
Kate Lorig from the Gaucher's community.
Phil Ruff, I'm a panel member, and I'm with Shaw Pharmaceuticals.
Cindy Escobar-Alvarez, I'm part of the panel and program officer for medical research at the Dorsten Charitable Foundation.
Uday Deshmukh, I am a senior medical director at Florida Blue. I am on the rare disease panel and represent the PAIR.
Good morning. My name is Kara Walker. I'm the deputy chief science officer at PCORI. Hi, my name is Emma Drabali. I'm project assistant in Brian's office.
So we're going to ask Laura again, probably with Vadim. This is a joint presentation. Is that right, Laura?
Vadim's here to help us answer any questions that come up about our portfolio.
I see. So he's here for the hard questions. Okay. So Laura's going to speak about the analysis of PCORI review of applications on rare diseases.
Thank you. It's, again, a joy to come and share some of the work that we've been doing with you all. Can we advance to the slides? I don't have any form of clicker. Thank you. Wonderful. So you can go ahead to the first slide, Emma. We are here to report to you our analysis of our review of applications on rare diseases and how those fare. Thank you very much. Compared to applications on other conditions. And this whole effort came out of, I believe at your last meeting, questions that you all raised about the process and how rare disease applications are doing in our merit review process. So first we want to tell you what we have in our portfolio to date on rare diseases. You all have in your packets a handout that lists every project that touches on rare disease as we see it and the kinds of projects they are or the mechanism through which they were funded. And so a summary of that is that we have funded 12 projects on rare disease through our broad funding announcements. That represents about 5% of the total projects in our non-methods portfolio. We also have 3 pilot projects, 2 pipeline to proposal awards, and 20 networks. Through our patient power research networks and our clinical data research networks, or PCORnet, that are targeted towards rare disease, and that was by design that those networks would focus on rare disease. And so you can see in your packet the investigators, the title of the project, and the condition that those projects are on. So you have a sense of what we already have in our portfolio. So, the reason we wanted to analyze our applications coming in on rare diseases and see how they do is to understand whether applications on rare diseases fare differently than those on more common conditions in our merit review, and if so, why, and to identify some action steps for funding applications on rare diseases. And so the questions that we wanted to ask of our process were, first, how many applications on rare diseases are reviewed, discussed in the in-person panel meeting, and ultimately funded each cycle, compared to the numbers on applications that we receive on other conditions. And we also were interested in understanding, are applications on rare diseases less likely to be funded or discussed at the in-person panels than applications on more common conditions, and if so, why? And are applications on rare diseases less likely to be funded? And so we were looking both at the review process, how many come in, how many we discuss. I just want to remind you that we receive a large number of applications. They go through a preliminary review process. The top performing applications are discussed at the in-person panel where we have scientists, patients, and other stakeholders present to talk about the merits of each application, and then we ultimately make our funding decisions based on those discussions and information that we learn. So what we did was we first identified projects focused on rare diseases that came in through our broad portfolio, our broad funding announcement. And today we're focusing on those applications from Cycle 3, which occurred in March of 2013, through the Spring 2014 cycle, which was in May of 2014. And we're focusing on those cycles because of the robustness of the data that we have about whether or not a project is on rare diseases. And we defined projects as focusing on rare disease according to the NIH definition. And Vadim very dutifully applied that definition to our projects. And what we looked at was among those focused on rare diseases versus all other applications, how many did we receive, discuss, and fund? And we also compared the scores for each criterion and the overall scores by reviewer type. And so I'll show you more about that. So first, let's just look at the numbers we received. The total across those cycles that we're discussing is at the bottom. And as you can see, the number of applications on rare diseases that we receive is small, 44 across those 4 cycles of review. and it's especially small when we look within program areas. So the assessment of options program receives the most. They receive anywhere between 5 to 11 applications on rare disease in any given cycle, but our other programs receive at most 2 applications and sometimes none or 1 on rare diseases. And so we reviewed over this time 44 applications on rare disease compared to 1,383 applications on other conditions. We discussed 30 applications on rare disease and funded 9 compared to discussing 635 applications on other conditions and funding 124 other projects. So when we look at the likelihood of moving through the process, rare disease applications are more likely to be discussed. 68% of the applications on rare disease made it to the in-person discussion compared to 46% of all other applications. And then our rare disease applications were also more likely to be funded. So of all applications discussed, 30% of those on rare diseases were funded compared to 20% of those discussed that were on other conditions. And looking at the entire pool of everything that came in, we funded 20% of those on rare diseases compared to 9% of those on other topics over these 4 cycles that we're looking at.
Laura, could I just jump in?
Please.
I just want to make note that this just happened. In other words, this was what the review panels did. There was no specific policy with respect to treating rare diseases any differently. We're as surprised as you probably are. Go ahead, Uday.
This is Uday. One of the things that came up in the discussion was when we look at the common conditions also, have we tried to understand that the question that is being answered in that research pertains to the whole condition or only a subset of that population? Because the thing is, this classification becomes very artificial. But if you pick up a rare variant of a common condition and you try to apply a research question to it, it pretty much actually should equate to what we're trying to do in the rare conditions. So have we tried to look to understand as to when we say common conditions, it's a broad-based question?
We haven't yet drilled down into, among those almost 1,400 applications that came in on chronic conditions, we haven't carved it up further into whether they're looking across that condition or at a subset. That's a good point. Yep.
I'm actually very glad to see this diagram and the outcome. At some point, based on the discussion that we had last night, I would like to know, I guess the information can be on the website, but I want to hear from you what mandate PCORI got regarding doing research on rare diseases.
Mm-hmm. So you'd like to hear more information about what is covered in our legislation with regard to rare disease?
Yeah, because there was a question of the value of doing research on rare diseases, and I want more specification.
Okay.
Brian and I were just having a slide aside, but can you go back a slide, please? So on these are in response to topics or general call from PCORI, correct?
That's right. This is from the broad funding announcements for assessment of options, addressing disparities, health systems, and communication and dissemination research.
Are you going to speak later on how many topics actually persist that are pertinent to rare disease we've done so far?
The prioritized topics?
Yes.
Yeah. I have a slide on that that was presented previously.
On.
Yep.
On this slide.
Sure.
So the broad funding calls were equal for all of them. Isn't that health disparities was in one? And so each of
correct.
These four.
Correct. All 4 cycles included all 4 of those
okay.
Programs had broad funding announcements, yes. And so Ryan was correct in expressing surprise at seeing these numbers in terms of the rare disease applications actually being more likely to be successful at each stage of the process. I'll go back to my slide with our evaluation questions. I just wanted to highlight that these were very intentionally worded. Are the applications on rare disease less likely to be discussed or funded? Because that was, I think, our hypothesis, or at least an important consideration, and it turns out that that's hasn't been the case over this time, that without any specific direction, the review panelists were identifying the merits of these applications. I want to go on and show you what we learned about the criteria. We wanted to examine the criteria and the overall scores, and we wanted to do so across our different types of reviewers because we wanted to really understand if we could identify why or why not the rare disease applications might fare differently, because we wanted to consider, you know, we know when we're talking about things like impact and likelihood to affect healthcare delivery or even methods, when you're talking about very different populations and conditions, there's a potential for those criteria to be applied differently to our rare disease applications versus those others that we get. And so what you see on the screen here is the mean scores from the preliminary review. This is what the reviewers are doing at home before we come in to discuss the applications. And the takeaway point is that when we look at the overall scores, there's no difference across any of our reviewer types in the mean overall score of rare disease applications versus all our other applications. And when we drill down into the criterion scores, we see that the rare disease applications are scored equally well or better than all the other applications. So I want to remind you that a lower score is actually a stronger score in this case.
And Laura, yes. Would you identify what the criterion are?
Oh, yes, everybody? Thank you. That's a great point. Criterion 1 is impact of the condition. Criterion 2 is likelihood to impact healthcare delivery and outcomes. Criterion 3 is technical merit, which includes the methods, a methodological approach. Criterion 4 is patient-centeredness, and criterion 5 is the plan for patient and stakeholder engagement. And so the places where we saw differences between rare disease applications and those on other conditions were the patients scored the rare disease applications more strongly on average on their likelihood to impact healthcare and outcomes. The patients also scored the rare disease applications more strongly on patient-centeredness. And the scientific reviewers scored the rare disease applications more strongly on the plan for patient and stakeholder engagement. And so, again, I was pleasantly surprised to see this. I expected that we might have some areas where we would see a different picture than what we saw.
Yeah. Russell Teagarden here. I think we had this question in the other session, but again, it would be interesting to see those numbers broken down between the academic groups that might have been the PIs versus, say, coming from a patient group. Because I wouldn't expect a difference if you know, amongst academic groups, whether it's rare disease or not, I wouldn't expect that.
Mm-hmm.
But I would be interested to see how, if it's possible to partition, if they're how well the ones driven by the actual rare disease groups did.
Okay. It's a great question. We can look, and I wonder how big of a sample we have of that case to look at it, but we can certainly check. One of the discussions that we had in thinking about the criterion, for example, was, you know, do the rare disease applications have just smaller sample sizes or other things that might point to being reviewed differently on some of these criteria. And so we're going to have a discussion, and we have our Associate Director for Merit Review, Sahai Tafari, on the phone, and so she's listening in too, and we'll bring all this back to say, given all of this information now, what should we think about in our review process? Before we do that, oh, please.
So sort of following up on Russell's question, because we're going to have a discussion about ad hoc panels, or at least maybe we're not, with our survey was asking about the importance of ad hoc panels to contribute. Do we know, like in the patient category, how many of them actually come from a rare disease perspective? Or, I mean, to get a sense to evaluate whether that really is additive or even necessary, because I mean, if they're scoring well in the patients, you know, but is the mix skewed?
Sahai, are you able to answer that question about representativeness of rare disease among the patient reviewers?
I am not able to answer that right now, but I'm happy to look into that and get a sense of our patient reviewer population in general, what the representation looks like. I can say that if you just look among our scientist reviewers, about 5% indicated that they have their disease expertise, but I need to look more carefully for the patient reviewers and stakeholders as well.
Okay, thank you. And our last piece of, we'll get there. Our last piece of data that we have to share with you is the final overall scores by reviewer type for rare disease applications versus all other applications. And so on the left, we have just overall across all reviewers, and then again, we looked by reviewer type. And here we're showing you the mean final overall score and the standard deviation, which is really just an indicator of how much variability or range there is. And so the takeaway point here is that overall and across all reviewer types, there were no mean differences in the final scores for rare disease applications or all other applications. The mean and the variability in the scores was nearly identical. The overall range of the final scores, I don't know that off the top of my head, but we had it. Of final scores? The best score, if everyone gave it a perfect score, it would be a 1. And if everyone gave it the poorest possible score, it would be a 9.
So there's a pre-vetting process by PCORI staff before proposals come through. What was the percentage of rare disease ones that made it through that to being reviewed?
So I gave you the numbers that went out for review. And so your question is, some of them get screened out because they aren't comparative or a few basic things to meet the requirements for the funding announcements. And I do not know that question, but.
Yeah, at the staff level. If you're, you know, in other words, once they're making it through, they're doing quite well.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, actually a little bit better. It would be interesting to see if they're faring the same at the staff level.
Yeah.
Also.
Or do we have outreach and education to do for improving the application?
Well, and the reason I want to break that down into the groups or not is whether or not you tell and advise the patient groups, hey, go ahead. You're really doing great. You're doing as well as anybody else. Or is it alternatively, get yourself hooked up with an academic center, and then you'll be on an even run. That's the key question in my mind.
I'm going to ask I should have said this earlier, but for the sake of those that might be listening in, to identify yourself briefly when you speak. I also want to just make note here that since one explanation here that comes to my mind about what we're seeing is that this could be the cream of the crop. We have relatively few applications coming in, and it could be that that the rare disease community in general doesn't know we exist enough. And that if we start opening the floodgates, which I actually hope will be on the table here to really scare up many, many more proposals, but we could wind up with lower quality proposals that come in, and we could see a very different picture going forward.
So a summary of those data that I just presented are that we receive really a limited number of applications on rare diseases, but those that we do receive are more likely to be discussed and to be funded than other applications, and to score as well or better than other applications. I did want to bring back, this is a slide you've seen at a past meeting where you talked about topics submitted on rare diseases and, you know, the notion of talking about topics and how they get prioritized is a different but related issue to what we're talking about today with how projects do in the review process. But I just wanted to remind you that three topics made it to the advisory panel prioritization phase in the past, and I think none of those have yet to be included in the final list of prioritized topics. And I know you guys had a more detailed discussion about that in the past, but I wanted you to be able to keep that in mind as we have a discussion today about what are some next steps based on what you've heard today.
And that was, in a sense, the purpose of collaborative meeting, informal get-together last night to discuss with that prioritization panel the options panel, which is the primary panel that would be likely to prioritize rare disease topics, why I wanted you to meet with them to start discussing this process.
Hi, it's Marty. I guess my question was, do we have the scores of what was actually funded? Because when I look across the scores, they're not very good scores. They're not typical funding scores. And I wondered if the difference is that when you look at rare disease funded, you know, it would give me better perspective because the N that you're looking at it, the rare disease is so small compared to the N that's, you know, over 1,000. And then we're looking at all the average scores, and it looks to be about the same. You know, how many, what percent are in the higher scores? Because that would help to understand if it's from academic centers or non-academic centers and such.
Right. So I didn't bring today, although we certainly could produce for you, the average scores among those funded and not funded. I think...
Because even a 4.7 with a standard deviation of 1.7, it's 3, and that's not typically funded.
Right. So we were, in terms of funding, we were focusing on the proportion of applications that are funded among the different types, but we can, to help you better understand, we can produce the mean scores among those that are funded versus not funded. Obviously, those that are funded have a higher average score than the ones that ultimately don't get funded. So we can provide that. I don't have it with me today.
This is Marshall. One of the things I think as a panel that we need to focus on is we need to generate some topics. Now, we've got one that made it through, it looks like, for consideration around genetic testing, but there are other topics. The success rate of these is based on topics that aren't specific to the rare disease field. I think one of the senses, was everyone there last night for the open discussion? I think one of the things we realize is the hill we need to get over is kind of high because the perception is that our topics aren't broad-reaching and that they're not going to hit a lot of patients. So I think the burden's on us to actually come up with some topics that do cover large swaths that can be impactful and reasonable to do. I mean, I look at some of the other topics, and they're, yes, big, broad populations, but the actual difference those things may make may be minuscule, whereas I think we can design topics that have large impact maybe on a smaller swath of the population, but one that's acutely in need. So I would challenge us to work very hard on that.
And this is Brian. I don't think you should think of this as specifically your job to come up with topics, but I think to build on what Marshall just stated, I think it is your job, if you think this is an important issue, and I'm sure you do, to help guide us as to how we can get the community, the rare disease community, to come up with topics. So, I mean, we can hold meetings, we can have outreach, we can engagement is, you know, on our name in a sense. So I don't think you should think of this as this group here should be coming up with topics. You're not a prioritization group. If you can, that'd be great, but you certainly ought to be able to guide us, and we look for you to help guide us in that process.
And just as a follow-up, you'll find in your packet the final guide to formulate a CR question, and now we have that on our website to allow people to look at before they submit a topic so they know exactly what we're looking for.
Jason, you've just joined us. We're pleased you're here. Would you introduce yourself? This is a public meeting, and so we need to know that who you are.
Sure. All right. So red means on, I guess. I'm Jason Connor. I'm a member of the Clinical Trials Advisory Panel. I'm a statistician by training and a clinical trial designer by, I guess, what I spend my days and nights doing. And I'm here because it's our last meeting, these two overlapped, and we had dinner together, and many people in this group, you know, said what motivated them and why they're here and sort of issues of rare diseases. And this was during cocktail hour before dinner, and Brian turned to me and he said, I know you. I know you're going to have thoughts. What do you think? And I said, I have too many thoughts, and people are waiting for dinner. And can I have 30 minutes at your next rare diseases advisory panel? And Brian generously said yes, and so that's why I'm here for later this afternoon.
Thank you, Jason. Any more discussion, or go ahead, Laura.
Yeah, we have a fair amount of time on this topic, and so I guess initially I'm interested in hearing your reactions to these findings and how they align or not with what you expected to see.
Hi, Cindy Escobar. Thank you for the data. I think that the last meeting we had a lot of questions, and this at least helps eliminate some of this. We weren't sure as to whether the rare disease proposals that were coming in were competitive or not. How did they compare, you know, to other proposals? And I think this data suggests that they're reviewed, the review's fair and they're as competitive as the others, and it will help us, or at least what we know, with some limitations. I think it would help have some more granular data, but, you know, I'm a few persons. but it does help us eliminate that bit of it.
Can you say more about what more granular information would be of use to you?
For example, I'm not sure. So you presented the mean and the standard deviation. So I wonder if these are normally distributed. So I think just to see a spread of what the distribution looks like would be helpful, and maybe the median. And then compare broken down by between successful, and the whole pool in terms of scores.
I would like to respectfully...
Introduce yourself.
Yeah, Kate Lorig. I'd like to respectfully disagree. I think that we basically can see the problem here. I love data as much as anybody else. I spend my life playing with it. I can think of 50,000 different ways to cut and look at this, but I think the issues of this panel are greater. And the issues of this panel are, what are the priorities for rare diseases, and how do we generate more people that want to do research in those priorities? And I would urge us not to spend a huge amount of time looking at the minutia of data, because while it may be interesting, I don't think it'll serve the public.
Okay, just have a comment. So I agree with you, but I think there are also other data that could be helpful. For example, what Russell suggested of really knowing where the proposals come from and their success by source, you know, then we would know whether those that are submitted by patient groups versus researchers have the same success rate or is it different, and would suggest ways to engage with the patient community if that is an issue.
I think, Laura, one thing that just might be useful for the panel, I mean, we can do a drill down and things like that. If we could just get a list of the funded rare disease proposals.
Yeah, that's in your packet.
Oh, okay. Yeah. Perfect. But one of the things I'm thinking that we want to think about, too, is this just a case where someone used a rare disease model to answer a general population health question, which isn't really specific to the field of rare diseases, versus questions that actually are going to tackle rare disease issues?
And let me just address the discussion that we had between Cindy and Kate. I usually talk about zero-sum issues. This is not a zero-sum issue. Whatever Laura and their wonderful group and Vadim does would not at all impact our ability to move forward with other expansive issues. So we can do, in this case, we can chew gum and walk at the same time.
And so, Brian and Kara and others, please weigh in as we have this discussion here, but I have some other questions I wanted to ask of the group. One is, given what these data tell us, I am interested in hearing your views on what the benefits and also perhaps the unintended negative consequences could be if the rare disease applications were to be reviewed separately. Right now, all applications on any condition are reviewed in the same panels, and there's been discussions at different times about whether or not they should be reviewed separately, and so I'd like to get your views about that.
Let's just go around. Let's start down yonder, and just if you have an opinion, just kind of speak up, and let's roll around, because I'd like to get everyone to get some input.
Uh,
I am Jennifer Wolfenstein. I prefer that will be evaluated separately, because my feeling is that the people that will review those will be more familiar with their disease. They will understand better the issues rather than injected into the common diseases that will be some people that will say, well, you know, they will just not be evaluated fairly if they will be included with others.
That was Yaffa.
Kate, I don't have a strong opinion.
And this is Phil Nevedoyne.
I'm here, Cindy.
Can you say your question again?
Yes. The question is, can you say, in your view, what any benefits or also potential unintended harmful consequences there could be of reviewing the rare disease applications in a separate panel that includes only applications on rare diseases?
This is Uday. I think probably in previous meetings also I have said that probably it is a better idea in my mind. Because from a research protocol perspective, I find it very difficult to be able to sustain the models that have been propagated in the common conditions with broader populations to be replicated easily in rare conditions.
So I think separate review is fine, but I would take a more activist position and say that fundamentally a more robust inventory of topics needs to be generated. And while I appreciate your points about outreach, I'm looking at the time frame that was up on the PowerPoint of sort of 2 years counting. Did I get that right? So I do think we should be more activist ourselves. I wonder about the rare disease patient power networks, whether they could be a good source. So, yes, engage, that's great, but I think we also have to proactively generate.
Russell Teagarden here, yes. I am I'm strongly in favor of a separate review process, mainly to provide some special accommodation to the patient advocacy groups that would be submitting. As I said last night, these are mostly people who did not come to the research because they have an interest in it inherently. They didn't come to it because they have a great deal of training. These are not people that came out of NIH. They're people that want to come out of NIH. They're probably people don't want to know how to spell NIH, but they got to get this done. And so they come at it with a certain urgency, a certain ingenuity, a certain view that may not conform perfectly to the general approach to these kinds of things that needs to be accommodated, should be accommodated, just not for them, but also there's a lot of learning, as we've said, that others could adopt too. So I strongly support the idea of being separate, so long as that separate approach takes into account the special nature of these and is just not, you know, just not a separation of the same old thing.
Marilyn Bull, I think there is some great value in separate evaluation, with one caveat that I think it's important that it not slow the process by having to develop a whole new group of reporters and investigators and reviewers. I also have very strong feelings about the dissemination process, and I would like some time later to approach that if we could.
This is Marty. I strongly believe that it should be separated. And I say that because I think that that would be the best way to get the patient advocacy groups involved. When I look at what has been funded in the broad programs, they look to be all from academic centers and likely not including a lot of patient-focused groups because of the way that the topics are designed. And I really... believe that the data that you're showing, although comforting in a way, is not depicting what's actually going on And so I think that the best way to get the patient groups involved, if you had a separate topic that mandated almost that you had some patient advocacy group involved with it, then you would have true collaboration versus just having, you know, physicians similar to myself applying to a grant that happens to have a large rare disease patient group and maybe collaborating amongst other investigators but not actually answering the questions that the patients want.
So this is Jim. I'm going to respectfully disagree with my other panel members. I think what we heard from dinner last night was that impact is a big deal. If I look at this, if I read this correctly from the data you're providing, the impact, which is criteria two?
Impact is criterion one, and criterion two is likelihood to impact, likelihood to change clinical care and delivery.
Okay. So to me, one or two on the, in the data that you've given, if it, even though one may not be statistically significant, I would say that impact-wise, that is a particular issue. But I would challenge the review process to not separate rare diseases. I would say that the merits of the research, especially around the technical merits, should stand alone. I don't know necessarily the data that we're looking at shows that there's a bias per se for academic institutions or versus, you know, patients. But I would say that the other information gave us here on the grants that are being funded, I mean, these last 20 here on research networks, correct me if I'm wrong, these are patient-powered research networks in PCORnet?
Yeah, they're from PCORnet. It's a mix of patient-powered research networks and clinical data research networks.
So if you look at the topics that are being funded, I mean, these are, there are some broad topics in here, diabetes, obesity, osteoarthritis, as well as obviously a lot of the rare diseases that we're probably all very familiar with. So I would just say I think the research networks themselves are, I think, a good way for us to look at perhaps, I think, use some of the terminology we talked about last night, the bubbling up of research using PCORnet, I think, is a good solution. And I would just say that, you know, I don't think we need a separate process per se for rare diseases. I think we should challenge ourselves to not necessarily go with that, even though there are potentially some issues with impact. So that's my opinion.
This is Brian. I want to make clear that the entries under the research networks are not comparative effectiveness research studies per se. These are areas of expertise or interests, probably more than expertise, in terms of those patient-powered research networks. So they're not funded studies. They could develop into funded studies. This is infrastructure. This is, and you should think of them as networks within which one could do research on those topics.
This is Marshall Summer. Oh, sorry. But just in the answer to your question, I'm also kind of the mindset I don't think we need a separate review panel. I think what we need are topics that are relevant to rare disease. And I think that actually, when I look at this list, I mean, to be honest, frankly, the broad program things, they're using rare disease as a model for something else, pain control, reporting, decision-making, but not specifically to answer a rare disease-type topic. Well, a few of them are like that, but not. It also is a little bit of a weak portfolio around those rare diseases. These are things that, you know, just from, I review a lot of grants, everyone here looks at stuff like that. It's not a strong packet if I'm looking at it from a rare disease mindset. As far as that goes, I may be a little harsh. If y'all disagree with me, you can throw rocks at me later. But I think the if it's addressing a topic that's relevant to our field, I think that they should stand on their own in the regular review sessions. I don't think we necessarily have to do not only topics around rare disease, but then a special rare disease review section to review the topics from the rare disease.
So if I'm understanding correctly, I'm hearing you say that the broad funding announcements may not be the place where you're going to get the strongest rare disease projects. Rather, we need some targeted announcements that focus specifically on rare diseases.
Well, what I'd be interested to see is, first off, which ones made it through the initial vetting process as broad topics. We may have had a dropout there. And the other thing, too, is the outreach to the organizations that do rare disease. I think one of the things that we asked for was sort of, how do you actually phrase these questions so they're relevant? So I'm glad to see this document coming out and then pulling in some of the stakeholders. We're new to the field of large epidemiology and this kind of broad reaching. The groups that are going to come in are much better established in framing questions, doing large-scale questions. We're not quite as good at that as a field.
So this is that. I think, again, when you look at the research question, I think it just becomes a question of which perspective are you looking at it from. So I just wanted to put my thoughts in perspective from there, that there is a concern that if you try to apply the same degree of stringent statistical rules to rare conditions, then the same review group, if they're looking at both, if they were to rack and stack the projects, that the rare disease or rare condition project may go lower on the scale because they may not have the same degree of merit if the same lens was used. So that was the thought process with which that comment was made. I think one of the other things I'm going to pick up from what Naomi and Russell were saying before was more related to not just a question of trying to review it from a perspective, but also how to source it. And one of the challenges that we saw in an earlier discussion was that there is a whole lot of focus on treatment. And one of the challenges in those research studies always is that those fundings or those requests are coming from those who are the clinicians who are trying to solve a clinical problem. And when you start looking at treatment as a question in some of the other categories, I don't have all of them captured here, but they were related to prevention, screening. We know that rare conditions, just by their nature of being rare, are never going to qualify in those categories for studies. So we're trying to, again, when we're trying to fit a rare condition into a mold of a common condition, we are handicapped to begin with on how we're going to fit all the buckets. The other thing is that there are situations that go across rare conditions that are related to access, that are related to caregiver issues, that are related to activities of daily living, disability, mental and social handicaps, which could provide a ground for thinking of different, and maybe those projects could not be considered totally clinical therapeutic projects, but maybe a clinical social type of a situation which allows you to answer those questions as to how do you improve the outcomes for these populations through interventions that are not totally designed on a therapeutic intervention designed by, for lack of a better word, a physician. So that's how I was thinking about it, and I'll stop there and let others contribute.
So I was distinguishing in my mind, the reason I was holding off on a comment was the discussion we're going to have on ad hoc panels versus separate review panels. And I think, to me, it's the supportive role that an ad hoc panel could play within the mainstreaming process. So saying no panels doesn't mean that ad hoc panels couldn't serve a role to support the review process. And I see these conversations as linked, so I didn't want us to prematurely draw a conclusion until we get to that discussion later. I personally like the idea of mainstreaming so that we are, you know, within an overall process, but I see a very important role for the ad hoc panels to potentially support the rare disease applications as they move through both pre- and post-award, and that was the survey that we had last week.
Russell Teagart here. My worry is a sense, if there is a sense of futility amongst the groups, if it's there, and maybe Laura, you know, digging down into the PIs here would tell us that, if there's a sense of futility and amongst the patient groups, that why bother? Because their time is so precious. And if a separate approval approach or review might help to overcome the futility, then I think it's worth it. If there's not, then maybe there's no need to.
Hi, so this is Sai Torian, Associate Director of Merit Review, and I just wanted to chime in and just say that the process for reviewing applications, whether mixed in with the other broad applications or if they were on a distinct panel, the review process itself won't differ. What would differ who is on the panels? Which reviewers are we targeting to recruit for those panels? So please know that the process will be fairly consistent. It's just the types of expertise that we will recruit will be pretty different. And that's true for the applications that go on the broad panels when they are intermixed with the other applications we receive. We recruit based on topic. The difference would be that there'd be a full panel assembled and together. That would be a group of rare people with rare disease expertise. So I hope that's helpful.
So I don't... Naomi Aronson. I don't want us to fall into the box of thinking that rare diseases are always so small that they will always require exceptional methods. What is striking is the diversity of rare diseases, that is, the range in occurrence and frequency of those populations, and also, quite critical to the size of sample you need, is whether the course is heterogeneous or really quite uniform. And I just want to give a specific example from our experience as an evidence-based practice center. We did a report on bone marrow transplantation, in quotes, in pediatrics and children. So many of the subsets we were looking at were refractory cases of a disease that was not in itself so rare, but the subset was quite rare. And what was really heartbreaking is to actually see that for those children, if you look internationally and if you look through time, there were fairly robust numbers of patients. What was lacking was any systematic or uniform research plan so that you got data that would accumulate. It's a terrible waste, and I think we need to avoid a certain kind of stereotype thinking that would encourage us to repeat that error.
If I was going...
Kate Lorig.
If I was going to look at a culprit of why not more rare diseases, I would go way before the review panel, because this seems to me to be a pipeline problem. And I'm looking at a document, the PCORI document, that tells me as a researcher what I can write for. The third criteria states in black, bold black, the research focuses on conditions that have the greatest impact on the most people. As a researcher, I don't have to read any further than that. I know not to apply for rare diseases. And it seems to me that if we want to make a change, the change needs to be there, not playing around with the minutiae of panels.
Exclamation point, huh? So let me also just make note here that may not be obvious to some or all of you. And that is, there's a huge difference between a prioritized project that becomes a targeted announcement or a topic of priority that gets listed in our pragmatic study announcement more generally, and a broad announcement. The broad announcements are limited to up to 3 years and $1.5 million, whereas the targeted announcements are 10 million all the way up to 20, 30 million. So we're talking about a huge difference in the scale of research depending on whether it's an identified, targeted issue that the Corps should go after versus an open call.
Yeah.
And what you see right now is all the open call investigator-initiated, much smaller, obviously less ambitious studies.
Yeah, I would just say that it's fine to go after targeted, but if you've already made very clear in the community that you're not welcome, then what I'm saying is by this call, what this call, your broad call says, is you're not welcome. And so you can target all you want, and you'll get proposals, those people that kind of dig deeper. But the broader community has already decided, and I work in an academic institution. I've talked to people about PCORI, and it's widely within the rare diseases, at least the folks I've talked to, it's pretty clear
this is not something that they want. And I think it's fine, you can target and you might get to some of those folks, but I think we really have to change this call and work down from there, not up to here.
Thank you, Kate. And I have to say, in looking at the data that we found in answering these questions, that you had a better review process, the most notable point to me was the numbers of rare disease applications that come in the first place, because as you say, no review process can fix the fact that we didn't get enough applications to start with. So one of the other points of discussion I wanted to hear from you about is elements of outreach and also what we should have as our reasonable expectations about applications to come in on rare disease and what groups are out there working that we haven't tapped into that may be ready to go given the time frame that we have to fund these projects.
Yeah, I'd like to chime in on that one for exactly. And one of the, and in a broader sense, I'll talk later, but in a brief sense, I think one of the barriers is this network utilization. And maybe you could comment just a little bit about cross-center, facilitating cross-center proposals so that the IRB is not so onerous and it's not just an overwhelming process that we can't overcome.
I just wanted to add a little bit of information because I think this is Kara Walker from PCORI. One of the things that we could hear from the panel on is whether our initial criteria number one on impact needs to somehow be adjusted. Right now, the title of it, I think what Kate was reading is the title of it says the impact on conditions and populations. And then there are sub-bullets within that, which we've always said and conveyed that we're not only talking about conditions that impact large numbers of populations, but also impact rare disease. And it's called out in a sub-bullet. But that doesn't mean if the initial read is somehow telling people a message that we don't wish to convey, that we can't revise that and revisit it. We do right now look at this data as part of what the investigators think is important comparative effectiveness research. They're sending us their ideas, their topics, their research questions. But we also have a separate prioritization process, and we, you know, may say that we need to work more closely with assessment of options, as we discussed last night, to create a separate targeted funding announcement that has very tailored review criteria, in addition to having a separate review panel that has expertise around the table, methods experts and other stakeholders and patients, just like we do for anything else. So it would be great to hear the panel's thoughts on those different aspects, because we can do all the outreach in the world, but if your read is, you know, these criteria are just pushing people away as soon as they read our announcement, we really want to hear that. We do have language that's from our legislation about our interest in funding rare disease research, but maybe that's not strong enough.
Okay. Naomi, I want to make an analogy. You know, years ago, if you applied for a mortgage, it was really onerous. There was all this paperwork to collect. It was really hard. You know, there would have to be a huge motivation for refinancing. Now you call them up, 20, 48 hours. You get a little sheet with all the data filled in. They say, is this right? Is this wrong? You change it. So I think what we're hearing is we're trying to reach a community, especially if it's a patient-led community, that really is not tied into the infrastructure of going after grants, going after research. So what if we were more like those mortgage companies and looked for the really good ideas out there, tried to help them to create the proposal in conjunction with matchmaking with academic institutions or academic investigators that would commit themselves in a generic way to promoting rare disease research and set up kind of a exchange facilitation incubator so that we could really, as Kate has said, there's a pipeline problem. Could we address it that way?
We actually have engagement awards to do exactly that. I don't know to what extent that they've been useful in rare diseases, but that... Yeah.
kind of building on that, you know, right now it looks a little bit like the classic model of NIH where you have the funding agency here and then everyone else is out here and you have to kind of assault the walls of the funding agency to actually get anything. Is PCORI prevented from having a more interactive process with potential applicants, basically going to a NORD, going to a Genetic Alliance, going to CF Foundation, Sickle Cell, and saying, okay, sit down with them, saying, what are the questions that you're having trouble answering? What are things where we can, you know, it still has to go through the process of being vetted and scored and everything else, but you can get your topics that way, whereas otherwise, I got to admit a little bit, yeah, when you do look at this as saying, if I'm picking this up and I'm thinking, okay, I can write 3 grants this cycle. Am I going to write one on a rare disease where it says the research focus on conditions that have the greatest impact on the most people? Am I going to spend my time there? Or am I going to go do it on the NIH where, what is it, 13% of NIH projects involve a rare disease, something like that, Yaffa? I think those are the latest numbers from there. I'm going to go where I've got a little bit more understandable model. So are you guys prevented from doing that kind of outreach?
No.
And in fact, we have a, this is Kara again, we have an entire engagement department and an engagement program and funds set aside to do this work. And we convene meetings all the time to get ideas to the table. And we did that very early on to even create the charter for this panel. So we're very interested in doing that. Not only are we not barred from doing it, we want your guidance on who to reach out and how to reach out and figure out how we get more questions into the portfolio.
Yeah, I was going to say, I'm going to keep harping on this language, because at least in my institution, one of the ways that this works is every day I get a list of all possible grants, maybe 5 to 10 a day. I look at the titles. No, I am not interested in the genomics of X. But then there's maybe one or two that I'm interested in. So I click on it, and I see this criteria. I make my decision based on that. That's the way it actually works in the real world. And I don't know whether this language is legislated or not. If it's not legislated, then I think we have to, I mean, I'm not opposed to engagement. I'm not opposed to any of these other ideas. But until we change this language, that's the entry point. And I make that decision in 20 seconds and never look back.
I would just like to build on your comments and Brian's response that, no, we're not precluded from doing the outreach. But is there someone, I'm looking for simplification in terms of who does, and backwards, if there's a rather loose network but would be interested in proposing a project, who, how, and who do they talk to directly to make sure that it's done correctly and effectively? And the time frame, I'm hearing 2 years, I'm hearing 2019. I think I need a little more explanation about that. And if I can add one more thing, I still don't understand the network connections and how we avoid the, not avoid, but address the IRB issues in multi-centered research.
So that's 3 questions.
So I think I remember all the questions. This is Kara. So PCORI has funds through the PCORI Trust Fund through 2019, and so we are looking at a 5-year funding plan right now, which Brian presented today. It doesn't mean that in the next 2 years we don't want to get more funding out the door for pragmatic clinical studies, but we do have 4 years to commit funding and a tail that will allow us to continue that research forward. The IRB issues are tricky, and that's actually, I think, to Mark's point earlier about these pre-award questions versus post-award questions, we see the ad hoc rare disease panels as providing a lot of help with overcoming some of these challenges throughout the research, throughout, you know, past the selection of important questions and important studies, but really how you overcome ongoing challenges. PCORI, our engagement team, and others are trying to help facilitate what it means to have patient engagement early on and what it means for IRBs going forward. They're not simple issues, and for certain, we're not going to I'm not going to answer that question very fully at this moment. And then the third question I actually did forget. You'll have to remind me. Oh, the network. So the PPRNs are definitely a part of where PCORI wants to go, and actually if Vincent were here, he could talk to it much more in detail because he's part of one of the PPRNs. So these infrastructure projects are being set up to be research-ready by the end of 2015. Phase two of PCORNET has just been approved by our board, and we plan to move forward with having research built onto these platforms, but it probably won't be until 2016 or so. And then it's really around certain collections of patients, and you can see from the list of the PPRNs, they are around certain rare diseases. And so, you know, we want to think about a sort of a balanced portfolio, not only around cell disease and you know, other kinds of rare diseases that are already in the PPRNs, but go beyond that with our outreach strategy. And so we have to really think through that. But clearly we need to invest in infrastructure to make this more accessible. Our clinical data research networks also have to have some rare disease component because it is a priority in our legislation, and we're still trying to figure out, you know, how we're going to pull research into that. As Brian mentioned earlier, it's not an easy thing to do. We have to figure out the right research questions, how we support it, how we monitor the methods going forward.
This is Yaffa. I wanted to go back to what Marshall said in terms of program being more interactive with the community. And I kind of agree with that, but I think that the process by which we interact should be very be done cautiously, because how would you decide who is the group that you're going to interact with and to what extent? So to be that, because that can create also this a little bit problematic.
I'll just kind of respond to that, because I think, yes, you could say that suddenly you're playing favorites or this group gets special treatment and this one doesn't. But if we've got no groups, then we've got to start somewhere. And I think maybe one of the things that would be useful to us as a group would be give us a contact point of who you want us to put these groups in touch with. I can guarantee you that everyone, well, just give us a specific chain of action. Who, what do you need for the info, and then, you know, making sure that we can make those connections and then let that roll. We can do that. Everyone in this room's got those kind of connections for that. That's one of the reasons we're on this committee in the first place. And I think that's something we can all do very easily with a very low pain threshold. All right. Great.
Let me just finalize this. This is the reason you're here. I mean, let's face it. But Corey, we've got a lot of things on our plate, and we're trying to keep our heads above water and do the right thing. And we have advisory panels such as yours to keep resetting ourselves and to do what we say we will do and what legislation wants us to do and so forth. So don't get too frustrated. I know, well, you're not, that's good. But the point is that your comments, these specific comments about our doing a better job in being able to be a resource and to help guide the process and so forth is you probably will be taken quite seriously. I'm taking them quite seriously right now.
Is not a stranger to our doorstep.
All right, so we have a 15-minute break.
Yeah, 15 minutes. Yes, we are on track.
Go ahead, talk to us.
And so we'll be sitting in on the assessment of options panel meeting, which is to the right of the registration table. And they'll be prioritizing the genetic testing topic.
Uday and I are going to be talking about that. It's the one around testing. That's one of the topics that actually has made it all the way through to consideration. So, you know, cross your fingers and sit in there and look really positive, things like that.
Yeah, so for those of you who are on the phone, this line will be silent until 1:30 p.m., and if you want to listen on the assessment of options, the dial-in information is on our website.
Good afternoon, everybody. We are ready to launch into our afternoon session. Appreciate everybody coming back after a very, very quick lunch. Just a note about this past hour and a half with the options panel. We don't have time right now to debrief, but I can at least say that I was just very pleased at the engaged process and how seriously they took the challenge to deal with the rare disease issue and to embrace, you know, this panel as an expert consultation, and they want to go forward with it. And this was something that you asked for really early on, interface with the other panels, and you're actually making a difference in the sense that you're guiding us and you're guiding, I think, our colleagues. And this is why Jason is here now. If you recall, we had that very interesting lunch or dinner and reception a few months ago, and out of that came a number of issues that we're continuing to explore, but one of them is that Jason in his drunken stupor agreed to come here and talk to you. That wasn't really fair. But it was over drinks that you said, you know, I'd like to come and address you, and I have some ideas about, you know, how you actually can do trials in rare diseases. So with that, do you have anything, Marshall, you want to say?
No, other than, Jason, thank you for coming. I got to preview your slides. I think you guys are going to enjoy this. But I also think this is an important element in educating our own panel about some of the things that are going on out there and what other folks are thinking and these small group sizes and things like that. So, Jason, take it away.
All right. So I think this is going to be a challenge for me because I tend to be all over the place giving talks. I once fell off the stage giving a talk. Sitting down while probably safe is not something I'm used to. But thank you for having me. So I think there are really no statisticians by training in the room here, right? You are? Okay. So that increases my worry a little bit. I think if I gave this talk to a room full of statisticians, one of them would be sent out to Lowe's to buy pitchforks, and then they would run me off. And I say that partially seriously. I think that I think this is going to be really well received by this group, and I think this exact same talk to a room full of statisticians. Half would think I was just a fool, and half would think it's impossible and that I was crazy, which is why I'm giving this talk to you guys. So I don't usually start with quotes, but I gave a talk a couple years ago to the National Breast Cancer Coalition. And I never get nervous giving talks. And I was so nervous giving this talk because it was to advocates and it was to patients. And I think all statisticians are guilty sometimes or all the time of thinking of subjects as subjects and not thinking of them, you know, as patients or moms or sisters and things like that. And so just their motivation for clinical trials was so different than mine. I was really nervous. And I found this quote about dying people don't have the time or the energy, and we can't keep doing this one woman and one drug at one company at a time. And partially that's why I was there, to give a talk about adaptive designs and how we should do trials differently, but I really love that. I run into all the time dealing with FDA this idea of, like, the tyranny of mathematics, and I just pull my hair out sometimes and think, like, that's crazy that you're letting, you know, some dogma of mathematics overcome what should be common sense in how we do clinical trials. And then the last one here with Jim Kim, who founded Partners in Health with Paul Farmer and did a lot of things in Haiti. I love, this is one of my favorite quotes, that people think we're unrealistic, but they don't know we're crazy. And I think about my boss all the time, Don Barry, who, in, you know, starting in the 70s, said we should be doing Bayesian trials, we should be doing adaptive trials, and, like, people wouldn't even talk to him because they thought he was nuts, and they said that's the wrong way. And somehow he didn't get discouraged. I would have gotten discouraged after 2 years of that. And somehow after 20 years, he was still not discouraged, and he was saying the same thing. And people started doing it a little bit, and now people started doing it a lot. And in 2006, he hired me as kind of the third person in his company, and now we're 15, and now Bayesian adaptive trials are kind of exploding. And I think in the 70s and in the 80s, people thought Don was unrealistic, and they didn't know he was crazy, and thanks to that, I met Brian, and I'm here. So a quiz for y'all. It's always good to start with a quiz. Why were standard statistical methods invented, and who invented them? Does anyone here know? That's a good one. That's not my answer here. But right, so the student t-test that everybody knows was invented by a guy who worked for Guinness because he was doing kind of industrial statistics, right? Along that same time, then, does anyone know where most statistical methods that we use all the time in clinical trials were invented? So some of the great graduate schools for statistics in this country are Purdue and Minnesota and Penn State and Texas A&M. They're ag schools. So, you know, guys like Ronald Fisher and Neiman and Pearson did things in agricultural statistics. And so the original study subjects were seeds. And they weren't patients. And methods that we still use today weren't invented thinking about patients or the individuality of study subjects. But they're still the methods we use. And that's kind of an important thing to keep in mind when we think about, yeah, maybe we should do things differently.
World War II, Fisher and Pearson, very involved, and that's when they really got the...
I think Pearson and Fisher were very involved in World War II.
Yeah,
and then they had to find something to do after the war, right, and wound up in some of these areas.
Well, no, before then, because Jersey Naiman's dissertation from, I think, the late 20s is called The Application of Calculus and Probability Theory to Studies of Agricultural Experiments.
I'm thinking
it's
Fisher and Pearson, World War II guys, yeah.
But yeah, yeah.
But when they had to break the German code, they brought in the Bayesians.
Yeah.
And I would add that Gregor Mendel started with pea plants. So,
yeah. No, his data has been proven to be false.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Actually, that's what we all know that.
Yeah. Right. Anyway. Okay. So that, you know, we're just going to come back to this idea of, you know, where did our methods come from? And if really we were inventing statistics today, would we really end up in the same place? So has anyone seen the TED Talk on the Marshmallow Design Challenge? So it's a very cool. Okay, we got one. So it's a very cool thing. The link's at the bottom here. It's a guy named Peter Skillman, breaks people into teams. It's kind of a team building exercise. And he gives them 20 pieces of hard raw spaghetti, a meter of tape, a meter of string, and a marshmallow, and says, you got 18 minutes, go. Design the highest tower you can, and at the end of the 18 minutes, I'm going to measure how high you can get this marshmallow. So when it's a team-building thing, and he's done this with a bunch of different groups of people. And a second TED Talk on the same thing here by Tom Hujek kind of shows some data. And he's observed many, many different types of groups doing this. So you can see the average here is like 20. Fortunately, and thank God, architects and engineers are really good at this. Anyone guess who the two low groups there are on the left? These are highly educated people.
Statisticians?
Not statisticians, not physicians. It would be interesting to know where physicians are. Someone said lawyers, right. So recent business school grads and lawyers do worse than average here. Then on the right, the one that's also a little below average, or CEOs. Somehow when you add an executive assistant to the CEO group, they get demonstrably better. And then there's one more group here that's above average. You know, they're not as good as architects and engineers. Any guesses on who that above average group is? Artists? Oh, that's a good guess. Kindergartners. So, and the explanation here that they give is observing these, kindergartners don't waste time. They don't sit around talking about what they're going to do. They just grab stuff, and they start doing it, right? And if one, like I have a kindergartner, if somebody grabs stuff, she's just going to grab the other pieces of spaghetti and start doing it herself. And so you got teams working in parallel, and they just go. And they're not afraid for the thing to fall down, and they just pick them up, and they build it again, right? And they just keep going, and they try, and they fail, and they try, and they fail. And an interesting thing they talk about is they tend to keep, whoever gets the marshmallow, tends to keep the marshmallow on top. And they, you know, kind of build up underneath and make sure that the thing can hold the marshmallow as it goes. And he compares this to MBA grads who spend a lot of time talking about what they're going to do. And he jokes that they spend the first half arguing about who gets to be CEO of Spaghetti Tower, Inc. But one of the things people learn, like in MBA programs, is they're trained to think about a single best plan. And they're trained never to fail. Versus kindergartners, it falls and they build it back up, and it falls and they build it back up. And if you think about it, if you've got to get it right the first time, how effective is your design here going to be? And one of the interesting things they do is they build this tower after talking about it for a long time, and then, you know, at 17 minutes and 50 seconds, it goes 10 seconds, and someone very delicately puts the marshmallow on top, and then often the whole thing collapses, and they have no time to build even a short tower. So what's the takeaway here is that we learn by doing and that by working in parallel and just trying lots of things, we can explore more interesting things here. Being the first to market is usually bad. You know, it's important, but oftentimes we can then improve upon those things. And then all projects have resource constraints. So a lot of this, you know, has kind of had this tone of like trial and error. Let's try things and see what works and learn from it. And so my question to you is, can we do rare disease trials by trial and error? Okay. But is that good? Are we in a good place doing that? Brian probably knows where I'm going with this. Or are people thinking, you said tomorrow's group would think you're crazy. I think you're crazy right now. So I say absolutely, we can do this by trial and error. But, you know, you might be thinking, well, you know, our resources are even more scarce than other clinical trials, and they sort of aren't very good either, doing it by, you know, trying and error. But so I'll come back to how we can efficiently do this by trial and error. So I'm going to start here with the ECMO example. So people know the ECMO trial. It's a pretty famous clinical trial. So this was for, you know, premature babies. Hearts and lungs weren't really developed yet. And by putting them on basically this bypass machine, you know, and apologies to the physicians here who could describe this way better than me, you know, it gives the heart and the lungs time to develop, and the historical survival rates were believed to be less than 25% for this group. And a trial group at University of Michigan designed a trial, and I'm about to describe the methodology, but it's kind of called this randomized play-the-winner strategy. So the way it works, you can imagine an urn with an ECMO ball and a conventional medical therapy ball, and a first patient comes in, and you randomize. You shake up this urn, and you pull out a ball. Let's say you pull out the ECMO ball. If the patient then gets ECMO and survives, you add another ECMO ball to the urn. But if the patient dies, you add the other ball, the conventional medical therapy case, in that case, to the urn. And by just repeatedly doing this, the probability on average should tend to increase on the best treatment, and the expected number of patients who get the better treatment is bigger than 5 or bigger than 50-50 randomization. We, of course, don't actually know that ECMO is better, so we don't know which one is the better treatment. But using this process, on average, more patients will get randomized to the better treatment. So this trial was actually run. And so this wasn't necessarily a rare disease, but I use this as an example because this is a case where, you know, in premature infants, these are really a patient population that if we can think hard and treat them as ethically as possible and find the answer as quickly as possible, we all agree that's a really good thing. So in that sense, I think this echoes sort of a rare diseases trial potentially, and I'll come back to at the end of why this isn't perfectly analogous. But the idea here is we want to find out the answer as fast as we can, as efficiently as we can, and at the same time treat patients as well as we can. So at the start, we have, you know, one conventional medical therapy ball and one ECMO ball in the urn. So there's a 50-50 chance that first patient gets randomized to ECMO. And he, in fact, did, and that baby survived. And so, by rule, we add another ECMO ball to the urn. So now there's a 67% chance that patient 2 gets randomized to ECMO. But he didn't. He got randomized to conventional medical therapy, and that baby died. So by rule, we add an ECMO ball. You add the opposite ball if the patient dies. So now there's a 80% chance. There's a 75% chance, because it's 3-1 now. Patient got randomized to ECMO, lived, and we add another ECMO ball. And the next patient had an 80% chance of randomized ECMO lived, and we kept going. And, in fact, all the subsequent 8 patients here were randomized to ECMO, and we kept increasing the ECMO probability. So that's how this trial works. So at the end of the trial, we had 10 patients. 9 were on ECMO, all survived in a disease that, or in a condition that they expected the survival rate to be 25% or less, which is pretty amazing. In the conventional medical therapy case, there was only one patient randomized to it, which it, like, I look at that data and you think, well, thank God only one baby was randomized to conventional medical therapy here. That was, like looking at the records, the sickest of all patients. And the question is, you know, as a statistician or as a policymaker or as a payer, do we have sufficient evidence to declare ECMO efficacious? Thoughts, do we? Does anyone think maybe we don't or need more data? This is only a 10-patient trial.
Controls are predictive, then I would say yes, you do.
Right, okay. That's I like that answer, especially as a Bayesian who believes in priors, that we should think, well, if that 25% is legitimate, we should incorporate that. If it's, you know, seeing 9 out of 9 on something that's really 25%, it's highly improbable. Right. But a lot of people think, oh, I need internal validity in my trial, and in this case, this trial isn't very good. But as a parent, of course, if you saw this data, there's not a parent in the world, I think, that wouldn't believe this data is compelling, even though there are statisticians and policy makers who might not completely find the data compelling. So, in fact, there was like a whole issue in one of the big stats journals after this came out that even said, well, how do you calculate a p-value with such weird data? It's not a randomized trial. You know, what do we do? And some very famous statisticians all calculated how they would calculate a p-value, and they got like 12 different answers, not even counting the guys. Well, you can't even calculate a p-value. There's no way to do that. So, the main players in statistics in the late 80s couldn't even agree on how we analyze this data. So maybe that was a failing of the clinical trial, is that, you know, the designers here should have thought about how exactly they should be analyzed, or thought maybe about, well, how will the medical community believe our results? Will we have enough data to change opinions of those with a wide range of prior beliefs? And even think about what trial results will look like. So maybe they did this by trial and error. I love this trial. I think it's a clever trial. It obviously treated patients within the trial extremely effectively. But unfortunately, it didn't change minds because there was a follow-up trial here. So they could have thought, well, even if, like, conventional medical therapy had a higher success rate than that 25%, even if it were 30% and the ECMO success rate was 90, there was a 6% chance that this process would put every patient on ECMO. So even though it was a randomized trial, there's a pretty good chance that every patient ended up on the same therapy, which is kind of weird, and would that be compelling? It probably certainly would have been good for everyone in this trial to have ended up on ECMO. But is it compelling in terms of one of the goals of clinical trials is also to generate compelling evidence? You know, I think it is compelling, but not everyone did. So there was a follow-up trial at Harvard where the strategy was to randomize equally between arms until there are 4 deaths in one of the 2 arms, and then randomize everybody else to the other arm. And so my boss, who I mentioned before at the time, was like adamantly opposed to this trial. And he in fact said, and I think this is like a bit brusque language, but he accused the designers of this trial of needing to see dead babies before they would make up their mind. And he is an extremely polite guy and an extremely well-spoken guy, and I think he's changed the way the world does clinical trials, and he only used that word choice because of how strongly he felt that this subsequent trial was an awful, awful idea, that we had compelling evidence from the first trial. And so in the second trial, you know, the success rate was actually way higher than 25% that we were told. It was, you know, 60% on conventional therapy. But the question is, were there 4 children randomized to conventional therapy who may not have needed to be if we would have just had compelling evidence from that first ECMO trial? So was this study design ethical? Clearly, you know, a lot of the smart people at Harvard thought it was. But do we have an irrational commitment to, you know, conventional randomized clinical trials?
Yes,
right. And that's what I knew the answer in this group would be maybe unanimously yes. And I think the answers might be different if, you know, we talk about this in our clinical trials panel tomorrow. And at least I certainly butt heads with plenty of statisticians who would say absolutely not. That's the only way to generate high-quality data. I hear you. You know, do we have an irrational commitment to P less than 0.05? So the case there, you know, if I invent another hypertension drug where there's a lot of hypertension drugs saying, you know, FDA saying, I want a really low error rate that this works, fine. But if we have something that's a fatal disease where there are no treatments, having a potential type 1 error rate, or for, you know, those who don't know type 1 error, the idea that we would approve a drug for a disease with high mortality where there are no effective therapies already, even if we erroneously have a chance of approving something that doesn't work 10-20% of the time, maybe that's justifiable.
Have you seen Fisher's quote about how he arrived at 0.05?
Good.
I can't memorize it, but it is essential to see. He just kind of works it through. It's,
right.
it's just a couple sentences, and basically he said, because I felt like it.
Right.
And because I feel like it, this is now what is going to be the difference between true and false. And I use that to teach people who don't know about this, about what the P is, because most people I found in the rare disease community that finds themselves now in the research business that they never were, they automatically have been trained to think that P is nature's law
right.
about truth.
Mm-hmm.
And if you read his quote, you see that it's very, very much different.
Right, right. It was very much, you know, an afterthought and sort of in that paper he picked one rather than thinking in every circumstance. You know, I mean, every time we talk about diagnostic tests, when we create diagnostic tests, we think about the consequence of a false positive, a consequence of the false negative, and decide where to draw the line. And, you know, whether it's a point-of-care flu test or a screening test for AIDS when you give blood, you don't draw the line the same place to get the same sensitivity and specificity. Yet we draw the line the same place every time when deciding what's a positive in a clinical trial. And it just makes no sense whatsoever. But people keep doing it for God knows what reason. I think because people don't think enough. But, yeah. And in this case, does, you know, a lack of 0.05 mean we still have equipoise? You know, the Harvard designers here must have thought that by not having a p-value of less than 0.05, it meant we have equipoise, that we can continue to randomize equally, which seems equally as absurd. So, you know, I said earlier we can do this by trial and error, so no one's supposed to know what this means. But the key is I designed this ECMO trial, and I ran this ECMO trial 100,000 times. So with 20 lines of code, with 80 seconds on my couple-of-year-old computer, I can run this trial 100,000 times. So the key is I can think about ahead of time what could go wrong. Is this going to work? Is this not going to work? When ECMO actually is better, how often does my decision rule say it's better? When ECMO isn't, in fact, better, how often does my decision rule erroneously say it's better? How often does that, you know, this process randomize more patients to the better therapy? So I took the original ECMO rules and just, simulated this trial 100,000 times. 100,000 times took 80 seconds, like I said, on my really old machine. So, in a case where there's no difference in conventional medical therapy and ECMO, that they're both efficacious 25% of the time, there's only a 0.04% chance everyone got randomized to, you know, one arm here. Versus if ECMO is, you know, effective 75% of the time versus conventional medical therapy 25%, there's a 2.5% chance. You know, maybe the designers would have thought, well, that's, you know, not going to be compelling to people and they should change the rules, but I don't think they knew ahead of time exactly, you know, what those chances were. And we can think about, well, what's the probability that we would see even randomization? And we don't need to walk through all these. What's the probability the p-value is less than this magical 0.05? Well, if ECMO is really 75 versus 25 better, it's 12%. So even in this original trial, this is statistical power here. That's what we call power. The probability that our clinical trial finds a statistically significant difference is only 12% according to conventional methods. Well, if we said, well, what if we had, you know, this different decision rule? What if we just made up a rule and said, okay, if I get more surviving children at the end of the trial on ECMO than on conventional medical therapy, I'm going to say ECMO's better. What if we had that as a decision rule? Well, by simulating this trial 100,000 times, you could say, well, 89% of the time when ECMO is actually better, 75 to 25, we would say that it is better. So that's good. We want this number to be high. But the problem there is using this, you know, kind of simple decision rule, when ECMO is in fact no better, we would erroneously declare it's better 38% of the time. So that's probably too high. Like, that's the value that FDA and kind of convention says shouldn't be higher than 5%. So this decision rule is bad. But without knowing any statistics or anything else, we might say, well, what other decision rules can we come up with? Well, what if I made a decision rule that said if I see four or more surviving children on ECMO than on conventional medical therapy, I'll declare that a success. It's completely ad hoc I came up with when doing this. And with that rule, 59% of the time when ECMO is way better, we would, if we declared that, you know, a successful trial, 59% of the time we would declare it successful when in fact it is. And when, in fact, it's no better, only 2.7% of the time would this decision rule get it wrong. So these are actually great operating characteristics on something that, you know, I completely made up and is not based upon agricultural experiments that were in no way meant to trade off the ability to treat patients well while getting the right answer. And you can say, well, you know, maybe I want to do even better than 59%. And we could, you know, explore other trial designs. Then, well, what if we used 15 patients and we can resimulate, and maybe the people we're working with said, well, if we have to keep this value less than 5%, which is FDA's convention and kind of the way the world works for no logical reason, that we said, well, we still want this number to be higher than 71%. I'd like to get this right answer at least 80% of the time. And then you can kind of keep iterating with, you know, your collaborators or your stakeholders. And if you ran the trial with 18 patients using the same decision rule, but made the rule, if we observe five or more successes on ECMO than on conventional medical therapy, I declare ECMO better. By doing that, you get 80% probability that when ECMO is really better, 75 to 25, you're right in making that declaration. And when ECMO is, in fact, no better at all, only 3.5% of the time do you erroneously make the decision that ECMO is better. And the cool thing about this adaptive randomization scheme, then, is that by adding those eight more patients, you know, about six out of the eight, you're on average still putting on ECMO. And when you put patients on conventional medical therapy, it tends to be the cases due to random variability where conventional medical therapy actually looks a little more compelling. And, of course, if there's no difference at all, by adding eight more patients, we just put four more on each on average here. If we did a standard trial, so in the trial I just kind of ad hoc designed here with adaptive randomization and this decision rule that just says if we have five more successes on ECMO than on conventional medical therapy or more than five, our decision rule gives us an 80% chance to declare that we declare ECMO is better when in fact it is, and just a 3.5% chance that we erroneously declare ECMO is better when it isn't. If we did a standard trial and just randomized nine patients to each, it has 58% power, so ours is way better, and it has a 4.8% type 1 error, so we erroneously declare ECMO is better more often. And this plot just shows, like, if ECMO is, in fact, the same as conventional medical therapy, on average, we put nine on each. But usually, you know, if, in fact, it's the same, we run a conventional trial. We randomize just about half the patients to each arm, whereas when ECMO, you know, really is dramatically better, we randomize, you know, towards 75% of patients toward that best arm and really treat patients most effectively. So in summary, what do I believe we should do? And I'll say it again, you know, I'm not a regulator, I'm not a payer, I'm not speaking for PCORI or American Consultants, I'm just speaking for me here, that we should remember that current clinical trials were trained by people who were trained by people who had SEEDS as patients. We should remember that most statistical methodology is based on asymptotic theory, that almost all the methods we use basically have the assumption that our sample size is infinite. And, you know, the logic there is when we're doing a clinical trial of 400 versus 400 in cancer, 400 is close enough to infinity that the math works. But we're doing, you know, really small trials in rare diseases, we're not really that close to asymptotic theory. And so while we think even that the rules are good, you know, this is not what these methods were built for. You know, remember that most statistical methods really are one size fits all, and they're made for, you know, agricultural experiments, and they really don't fit in well in this new world of personalized medicine. And I think in a way, and I think this has been talked about, eventually all trials are going to be rare disease trials because we're realizing that, you know, even what seem to be big diseases like cancer are heterogeneous. And once we really understand those diseases and realize how heterogeneous they are, they're all going to be, you know, kind of rare disease trials. So I think instead of hiring, you know, people who just know all these methods, sometimes we should just hire smart, quantitative people with their heart in the right place. And this is kind of like hiring the kindergartners, you know, people without bad habits and people who, you know, aren't quite so quick to kind of just put dogma over, I think, decency of treating patients well. And that's probably one of the things that's offensive to statisticians. And that's okay. I've never shied away from offending statisticians, even though I am one. But we should really balance treating the next patient optimally with producing valuable long-term evidence. And I think a key is that no part whatsoever of accepted current statistical methodology in any way factors in treating the next patient optimally. None. You know, in the FDA guidance on adaptive trials, they have what they call well and adequate controlled trials. And they kind of list kind of adaptations that are generally well understood and not well understood and ones that are really kind of on like the bleeding edge of methodology. And none of their really well understood ones include treating the next patient optimally as part of the methodology. And we should really think far more about that and push people to consider the patients in the trial more. And if type 1 error goes up a little bit or if we don't understand it completely well with asymptotic theory, that's okay, because the patients are such a key part of this that a lot of people forget about. Not a lot of people, I think, in this room, but a lot of stakeholders and sort of gatekeepers to clinical trials, to think much harder about tailoring a solution to each unique problem. And I think right now people say, oh, your data is dichotomous, you do a chi-square test. Your data is continuous, you do this, rather than really thinking about, you know, more clever ways to do this. There's nothing that says we have to do it the way it's always been done before. And to me, I don't think I'd be a statistician if I just had to keep using the old ways. To me, it's only fun if I get to think about each problem individually and think, well, how would I do this differently or what's the best way? And then a key one, and I say this line a lot, is that the first time we run a clinical trial should never, ever be the actual time we run the trial. This is almost true, you know, 95% more of the time. But with simulation and all these things, we can take our data, we can, you know, take historical data and run them through a simulator and show stakeholders, regulators, IRBs, whomever, here's what this trial might look like. If this is what happened, would you be able to make a decision? Would you be content with how this worked? And if the answer is no, we can make adjustments in the trial and maybe come up with something that does work, something that we refer to as called, like, prospective postmortems. You can imagine, you know, I think everyone who's done a clinical trial has done a trial, and you get to the end, and you kind of got an ambiguous result, and you would think, oh, I wish we'd have just done this thing differently. So maybe we should sit around before we start the trial and think, well, what things at the end might be things we thought of, oh, we should have done differently, and maybe we can build in, like, an adaptation for that. You know, if there's a huge benefit to ECMO, oh, maybe we should have designed this in a way that would have increased randomization probability so that these, you know, vulnerable children were treated, you know, in a better way. But the first time we run a trial never has to be the actual time we run the trial anymore. And so my main take-home message here is we do research and we do clinical trials in hopes of eventually treating patients better, so why shouldn't we do clinical trials that treat patients better? And again, I think this isn't at all revolutionary to this group. I think it's common sense. But it's not common sense to, I think, a lot of trial designers. And I think it's hugely ironic that our job, is, or my job as biostatistician, is to evaluate, you know, whether, like, the latest technologies and lasers and fancy diagnostic tests and monoclonal antibodies work using, you know, methods that were developed 100 years ago for, you know, something that had nothing to do with lasers and everything to do with agriculture. I think that's amazingly ironic, and a lot of people don't get it. So I think one of the, you know, hearing at the beginning of this, like, how can this group make an impact? And, you know, I get the concern that if rare disease trials are evaluated up against, you know, some of the bigger trials, you would think, oh, the impact might not be big, or a reviewer might think, oh, I can do a trial in something with an incidence of 1,000,000, or I can do something with an incidence of a couple of thousand. And especially to your point, you know, and the methodology for the huge trial is really great. I know that really well. The methodology for this is one has low power and, you know, it has all the concerns that a small trial by nature almost has to have. So I think if we think of impact in that way, it's hard for the rare disease panel to make a splash. I think an impact might be in methods and how things work. I think one of my favorite things about PCORI is they got guys like Brian and Steve Goodman and others who are really pushing innovative methods. And so even in, you know, one disease where, you know, you encourage and endorse a trial that uses some more innovative methods, if that trial is positive, it may only affect, you know, a small prevalence of patients, but I think it could be massively impactful where people see, oh, this is an innovative trial that used, you know, new methodology that really treated patients well, got an answer in an efficient way, and I think then more people will be applying to PCORI in rare diseases and ideally, you know, even outside PCORI funding, more people will realize the benefit of some of these innovative methodologies.
You'll be quite pleased that one of the things we requested was a landscape review of methodologies around rare disease clinical trials, and that actually what we've been talking about as a group is not focusing on one disease, but actually trying to come up with better standards or at least public, you know, perception of standards around these rare disease trials. So we're, I think, on the very same page.
Good, good. Yeah, and so that's, if people have questions, I'd say, you know, we are doing a lot of this. You know, our little group were, one of the challenges, a lot of rare diseases are just really slowly progressing. Here, you know, they had the luxury of they got the answer quickly in ECMO. But we're doing things, for instance, in GNE myopathy under an NIH-funded trial, so I get to talk about that one, where one of the things we're doing is taking lots of, you know, retrospective data. I know lots of rare disease groups have registries and things like that. And understand the historical clinical progression of the disease, you know, even in a multidimensional setting, so that when we start doing trials, which we realize we have to do efficiently because there aren't many patients with this disease, we can use that, you know, vast historical database and understand, you know, how we're affecting patient trajectories. We're not just looking at, you know, one endpoint in a couple of years, but rather, you know, trajectories of patients and things like that. So I think we need more sophisticated methodology, especially for, you know, slow progressing rare diseases.
But Jason, are Russell Teagarden here? Are you? What about the role of the journal editors? I mean, the academics who might want to do this, who have to publish, can't because the journal editors kick it back, or NIH reviewers, are they kicking these kind of innovative? I mean, how much is the externalities, if you will, affecting this?
Right. So I think that's a great question. I think that the NIH one might be, and I don't, I do some academic stuff, not a lot. The NIH one is a good question, a good concern. Like most of what I do is with FDA, and FDA certainly plays their role as gatekeeper well, sometimes too, in a very frustrating way. But one of the benefits with FDA is I get to go and sit down with FDA and talk to them, and they say, well, here's why this is completely wrong and crazy. And I get to have a conversation and say, well, why it's not, and spend time and, you know, even have private calls sometimes with the statisticians to get to talk through. With NIH, we don't have this luxury, right? We submit the grant. You don't know who's reviewing it, and if he's one of these, you know, old-fashioned people who believes this is the right way, you get a low score. But I think NIH is realizing, you know, that we can't keep doing things the same way. Guys like Mike Lauer at NIH and Chris at NCATS, I'm drawing a blank. Yeah, Chris Austin. So our group went and spent the day with Chris Austin and gave a lot of talks on things we're doing here. And I think they're learning they need to make sure when they get applications like that, that they go to open-minded and qualified reviewers. So I can't assure that that is happening, but I've heard, you know, people in powerful positions at NIH say we recognize that those need to get to the right people. And I think, you know, ideally we'll get some, you know, such innovative things through PCORI too, and people will realize that. Doing a lot of these and then publishing, journal editors haven't been as big an issue because in a way you get to have a conversation with reviewers. And I think, like, I get asked to review a lot of these. So I think that they find reviewers who do these, and so the journals don't seem to be the doorway. It's more, you know, things like NIH, but I think that's changing.
So let's use that model they used in the other room where just put your thing up on end.
So I am interested in pursuing more what this looks like under circumstances of a longer course of disease and more heterogeneity in outcomes. How does it look? How do you model it?
So that's a hard question to answer shortly. So, yeah, I thought about giving a talk on some of the GNE myopathy things we're doing, and I thought this would be more interesting or at least more controversial, which is always more fun. But I think it's hard. You can't always use 10 patients. I mean, obviously, if you have heterogeneity, you can't use 10 patients. Maybe I need to send you something. I think it's hard to just describe. But I think we're writing up that GNE myopathy paper, and I think it's a good example of how we can use, you know, longitudinal data and seeing how – and multiple endpoints at once and realizing that, you know, patients come in a progressive disease at different points. So one of the things with GNE myopathy is, you know, you lose function in different parts of your body with that disease in predictable ways. And so – you know, you may be at a part where now you're losing, you know, fine motor control and a drug has a certain thing versus another patient, you know, the drug for him may be working in a different way. So if we have, you know, one common endpoint, even if the drug's working, that endpoint might not capture everything. But because patients are at different points in progression of disease, by looking, you know, at things in a multivariate way, we're a little more sensitive to capture if the treatment's working.
May I just clarify? This is Naomi. So what I think is very important, and it relates to my remark of earlier in the day, of the really the vast spectrum of rare diseases. And I think it would be unfortunate to develop a mindset which in its own way would be sort of just as dogmatic that all rare diseases will fit this ECMO model, because that ECMO model is, you know, it's a really, really great case. And I think it would be very helpful to try to delineate the decision rules about where this works, where it doesn't work, how you can make it work better. Because we would run the risk of thinking that this one size fits all. And we really shouldn't be thinking of rare diseases as one size or fitting well all is a very challenging situation.
Right. No, I completely agree. And maybe this bullet here is lost. And this is what I do even on, you know, non-rare disease stuff. But just think about, you know, tailoring a solution to every particular problem. And that's actually one of the problems we have when we go to publish methodology, is that we've, you know, had a journal editor say, no one's going to pick this up and use it. Absolutely. No one should, because no one else's problem is exactly like this problem. Like, we've actually had that a lot. But the idea is, you know, we incorporated five different things in here, this decision rule, this randomization rule, this longitudinal model. And if someone reads this paper, when they're doing their study, they could think, oh, their longitudinal model is kind of what I have. Or, you know, this part of their problem I can borrow. And, you know, ideally, once the literature builds up that way, when someone thinks about a new problem, they're borrowing pieces from all of those different experiences, I think, and building, you know, the right trial for their situation. So I completely agree with you. And one of the challenges there is kind of publishing methodologically that way, because, yeah, no one is going to pick up my paper and do exactly the trial of, you know, the paper I submitted yesterday. But I think people can learn from it and inform them when they tailor, you know, their own trial to their own particular situation.
Marshall, summary, and then we'll go around. Can you also use this by opening up the number, the N in this, using a trial design like that to actually calculate? Because you don't always know your effect size coming out of that. So, in other words, if, you know, obviously you set a cutoff at some point, you're not going to enroll past that. But if you're enrolling to a certain point, can you actually then also use this to not only look at efficacy but effect size?
Right. Yeah, that's a great question. And one of the papers we've published, and kind of the name we gave it was Goldilocks trials. So the idea is you get the sample size just right. Because, yeah, we don't know the effect size when we start. And one of the – so there's a Goldilocks paper and a paper about predictive probabilities we've done. And the idea is you kind of, like, start enrolling, and generally outcomes are in the future. Let's say it's an outcome 6 months into the future even, at, say, 100 patients. You might and when 100 patients are in, you might have 50 with complete data, and 50 are still outstanding. And we can do the calculation. Well, what's the probability if I just stop enrolling patients right now at 100 and follow the 50 outstanding ones that when I have my complete data set of 100 patients, I have a statistically significant result? And if that's high, we can just stop enrolling right now. And if it's not, you keep on enrolling. And you got to put a cap somewhere. So let's say we put the cap of, like, our resource constraints. We can never do more than 400. Well, with 100 patients in and with 50 patients with complete data, we can also say, well, what's the predictive probability that even at 400 patients, based upon what we know, even just from this small pool of 50, and maybe we could have a prior based on historical data, what's the probability that at 400 we get a statistically significant result? And if it's ever really low, we just stop right now too, because we'd say, you know, we can expend all our resources and we're still have a little chance of having an error. Yeah, so that's kind of the idea of the Goldilocks trial there and really getting the sample size just right.
Okay. Yeah. A lot of folks with rare diseases, especially as they get older, have multiple comorbidities.
Mm-hmm.
And so you add that into the mix, and then you add the fact that they're on X or Y treatment, and it's unclear whether the comorbidities are a result of treatment or a result of a natural process or a result of having the first disease. How do you handle any of that stuff statistically?
That's hard.
I'm talking about all the covariates.
Right. And I'm not an expert in this. I know there are lots of people who do sort of, you know, counterfactual modeling where they're trying to model, you know, what's the probability that, you know, this outcome would happen if they were randomized to the other group and stuff. So I will agree with you that that's amazingly hard, and I'm probably not the best person to answer that question.
Thanks for being honest.
This is Uday. I think this is very exciting in terms of the new way to look at the data, and it goes back to exactly what we were talking before, that we need to define some different ways of statistical designs in terms of understanding it. I think the other challenge I see, there's a different challenge I see in this, which many of us have seen with statistics, is that once something is done, people try to put it through every statistical method to prove the point of significance. And I think what it does sometimes is it brings a lot more disservice or disrepute to the method rather than creating that confidence in data, and people go back and then that's where the people say, well, with statistics you can prove anything. So I think one of the advantages of having a forum like PCORI is to have an unbiased look at trying to see how these situations work, because we don't want to be in a situation where you create models that others try to imitate in such situations where they are trying to prove a point they could not otherwise prove of a statistical significance. So I don't know if it is a comment or a question, but the thing is, we'll have to go through it to understand as we go through this, is there some sort of, for lack of a better word, bookends that we can put that will allow the adoption of that research to be more general, so, and others not to really hijack the process to prove their point, which they did not set out to prove, when they have better power models from a statistical design perspective.
Yeah, I think that's a very insightful comment. I don't think I have an answer, but it's one of the frustrating things, right? Like, you know, my advisor used to say being a statistician means never having to say you're certain. But one of the things there is we also never know if we're right, right? I mean, we're pretty sure smoking causes lung cancer, but beyond that, it's like, you know, how many things do we think we know the answer to, and then, you know, we get contrary evidence eventually. Right, so, you know, we could come up with what seems to be a really clever method, run a trial, someone takes that data and they run it through their way, or the right way, as they might call it, and they get a different answer, and they can say, well, this doesn't change my mind. I mean, in a way, that's what happened, you know, with ECMO, and I don't know how you overcome that.
This is Uday again. If I could clarify my comment, I'm not so much worried. If we come up through a design model on a rare disease here and we say that's how we see it and we try to socialize it across the academia and other things, that is the one way that I'm quite comfortable with. It is the other way where the standard statistical method that could be applied to more common conditions when they fail to show result, are they going to hijack the process and discredit it? And I think it's a lot of conjecture, so I don't want you to think of this as a criticism of the method as much as I'm concerned about that we need to have some way of creating, well, as they say, different strokes for different folks type of a thing to understand exactly how, but create that type of understanding so that we can avoid the criticism also where people feel that they're picking and choosing what gets them the winning hand.
No, I think that's a great comment, and I didn't feel criticized at all. I think it's part of my, like, prospective postmortem, where up front you have to think what might go wrong in the end, and you might have something that goes beautifully and according to your decision rules that meets the definition of efficacy and whatever, but, yeah, we're always open to that criticism. And sort of one of the benefits of FDA trials, which I do most of the time, is we kind of agree up front. And FDA agrees to the trial, and if the data looks like this, you know, things get approved, and, of course, they don't always have to abide by that. But there's a dichotomous decision, approve, not approve, whereas in other things that are just in journals, you know, every clinician gets to use their own decision rule, so to speak, right? And they can choose whether to, you know, start using a particular drug or strategy or whatever. And, yeah, you don't have, you know, or they take the paper to their statistician at their thing and say, hey, I've never heard of this before. What do you think? And their statistician goes, what do you think? Oh, I didn't learn that in grad school. That's BS. But then he just tells them, oh, that's a bad method, you know. You shouldn't believe that. And, yeah, and I don't know how to get around that beyond, you know, some doctors are going to be more aggressive in uptaking things and some aren't, and you hit a critical mass. But it's a great point, I think, that I'm not sure how we overcome.
So, I thank you for the talk. I thought it was fantastic. I think that my understanding of adaptive designs is that it's just that, adaptive. So I'm not necessarily think that we need to have one adaptive model for all rare disease, just like we've been arguing all day that rare disease is different for it's heterogeneous. There can be 5 patients and there could be 1,000 patients. So from where I'm coming from, we've already been advocating as adaptive design within my field, but the struggle is actually getting it adopted. And I think that, you know, the more trials that are proposed to the FDA, I think that that will improve it. I also think that the adaptive design needs to be done early before the phase three, and that's probably the best utilization in rare disease because, you know, what ends up happening is there's not the claim is that there won't be enough evidence to go to the later stages, but I think that it has the most utility because the resources are small.
No, I agree, and something I thought about but didn't include here today was the idea of platform trials, which we're doing more of, which is, if people know, I-SPY2, but the idea is instead of having, you know, this company's trial with their drug versus placebo and this company's trial, you know, in I-SPY2, which is a breast cancer phase 2 trial, I think it's right now 5 companies and 6 drugs, they're all in there. And so the company isn't running the trial, which took a lot of faith for the company to kind of give their drug over. But the beauty is we learn as we go, oh, Merck drug is working in HER2 positive. You know, GSK's drug, and I'm just using examples here, is working, you know, in estrogen receptor negative or in triple negative. And then when a patient comes into the trial, rather than just getting in the Merck trial, because that's what their oncologist was contracted for, the adaptive randomization actually says, oh, you're triple negative, you get a higher probability of getting the GSK drug. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous trial. And we've had multiple drugs graduate because that's what you do. And there's 6 drugs at a time in the trial. There are prospective rules that say when you graduate, and when that happens, the company then at that point gets their data and they get to go run a phase 3 trial. And the beauty is they get to go run a phase 3 trial in a certain subtype of breast cancer, which means they can do a smaller trial because instead of looking for, you know, a little effect size because they don't understand, you know, the heterogeneity, they get to run a small trial that has a bigger effect because they actually know what type of cancer this is working in, and they have a, you know, bigger trial size from that phase 2 because there's such smart adaptive randomization. So, like, I-SPY2 has been written up in, you know, Wall Street Journal and other things. But, yeah, especially in rare diseases where – and where we actually got a contract from, like, the Gates Foundation to do this in Ebola, because with all the Ebola stuff, like, it would be great if we could test a whole bunch of things at once, and we want them on, you know, a level playing field. And right, so in rare diseases, I think that's particularly valuable there as well.
So this kind of speaks to the dialogue you and Uday were having. And this may be more of a style of communication than a reality, but I think it would be helpful to communicate principles of decision rules. It's not all made up all the time, because if we give the impression it's all made up all the time, we're actually undermining some very important principles that we have stood by over the years. So it's just a suggestion about how we express them.
Right. No, I think that's going to be my verbiage may have been a little loose there. I mean, you know, the decision rules we use were made up, as, you know, Russell said, by Fisher without a whole lot of thought. It's just that everyone, you know, now uses what was, you know, flippantly made up then. But, right, I agree. I think, you know, language is an important part of that.
So, Jason, first off, thank you very, very much.
Can we ask if there's a question on the phone, just in case there's anybody there?
Sorry, yes.
I don't know if there's anybody on the phone to be able
to
ask questions. But if those of you that may be listening or that are listening, if you want to send in your questions. Can you remind me what
you can either use the chat function or email us at advisorypanels@pcori.org.
And either we will answer it or more likely ask Jason to answer the question if it's technical along these lines. And let me just, first of all, also thank you so much. This is really inspiring, at least to me. I would think to the group here in general. In some ways, I want to make note that you're sort of talking to the wrong group. You did have to talk to this group for sure, but to the extent that there's a sense around the table that this is something that needs to be explored methodologically as we move forward with a research agenda, which is what we're planning on doing. It's important to bring this up to the Clinical Trials Advisory Panel, to the Methodology Committee, specific to rare diseases, and I think to PCORI leadership, and maybe even to the the advisory panels, because they're really just they're not getting into methodology so much as they're just getting into topic generation. But if you're willing to do something like that, does that sound like a good idea around the table?
Yeah, very much so.
Yeah, because we are in a position, and we're not the FDA, so we don't, and we're talking about comparative effectiveness research. We're not talking about phase two and phase three, really. We're talking about, doing research in real world, and it's a little bit more, like a lot more flexibility as long as it's generally accepted as appropriate. So if we've got PCORI and the analytical component of PCORI to stand behind this in a legitimate and an appropriate way, we ought to be able to put this into our funding announcements as something we are interested in doing. Okay.
Thanks. Do you have a business card?
Pardon me. So let's see what we have here. I asked Emma to tell me what I was supposed to say here next, so we'll see. I'm really anxious to find out. We want to talk about what does the legislation say, right? And this is what the legislation says. That we will have expert advisory panels for rare disease in the case of research studies for rare disease, that we will appoint an expert advisory panel for purposes of assisting in the design of the research study, and so forth. And so in many ways, the legislation envisioned a rare disease expert panel for a study as opposed to a rare disease panel for PCORI. We need to bridge this gap between the original intent of the legislation and the interpretation that PCORI put forth to create an overarching panel such as you. And this is the same for the Clinical Trials Advisory Panel. The legislation envisioned CTAP was in legislation too, right? Yeah. That we would have advisory panels for particular clinical studies. And so we are within CTAP, working with CTAP and also working with the methodology committee for major trials. We are identifying and recruiting subcommittees, we're calling them, to sort of oversee the methodological aspects of the trial. So the same kind of concept right there. So how CTAP is implementing the mandate, I just mentioned we've created trial-specific subcommittees for these three initially large PCORI-funded clinical trials. We have two obesity trials and one aspirin trial that is going to be, all of these trials are going to be done within PCORINET. And we're going to learn, pardon?
Only one of them.
Oh, that's right. No, I'm sorry. The other studies are going to be observational studies. And that these trials specific committees will report back to CTAPs. Thinking of them as sort of pilot efforts to figure out exactly how best to use the subcommittees relative to the specific trials. And this gives us sort of a roadmap of the process and management of the trial-specific subcommittees. And we're going through this process to give you a sense of, what we need to create here for rare disease trials as well. So in terms of communication, all communication between the subcommittee and the investigators of a project will go through program staff, so there won't be direct relationship between the subcommittee and the investigators. The nature of the advice we're talking about, again, with CCAP, has to do with all these particular analytical issues, inference, confounding, sample size, recruitment, accrual, and so forth and so on. And the selection process we're using is to select the members. We're encouraging CCAP itself to volunteer, as well as core staff for recommendations. And some of the CCAP membership can be on these subcommittees themselves, right? Yeah, sure. Kate?
Yeah, just go back to the last slide. The thing that I don't see there, and maybe it's outside the purview, but is advice on outcome measures.
Yeah, well, I guess we didn't see it as, and there's no particular reason why they couldn't. They wouldn't be barred from it by any stretch of the imagination, but the outcome measures are usually built into the whole process of the solicitation itself and the review process, the merit review process, where we have multi-stakeholder panels reviewing it and so forth and so on. So we don't see it as an analytical process.
Well, the reason I see it as a problem is because if you're looking at patient-centered outcomes, then a lot of those have to do with quality of life outcomes. And we know a whole lot about those measures, and some are much better than others. And well-meaning people sometimes choose the wrong measures because they're not sensitive enough to change, and they just aren't that familiar. Not all depression scales are the same. Not all pain scales are the same. Not all disability scales are the same. And that's why I'm coming with this, because I've seen this happen in too many trials where the trial has been lost because of the wrong measure.
In fact, we just went through a process with the first cycle of pragmatic trials, and the methodology consultation service that really came out of this kind of process was inserted after merit review. And in point of fact, there, depending on the trial and all, of course, the consultation absolutely dealt with issues such as the methodological issues associated with appropriate instrumentation to be used. So that would be included in this. This is not necessarily a complete list of analytical questions that the consultation would deal with. Naomi?
I would just like to add to that point that it affects not only the interpretability and quality of the trial at hand, but that it is very important for continuous accumulation of knowledge to be using standardized best measures so that you build a body of knowledge, not just a collection of studies.
I guess the point to this panel here is that you will have a role in identifying the nature of the advice that a rare disease subcommittee would provide. I mean, this is conjured up by those of us that have attempted to list the kinds of things that would be appropriate in this case for a methodological consultation process. So the CCAP infuses continuity by inviting merit reviewers and adding CCAP members and our external experts as appropriate to form these trial-specific subcommittees. And you want to go over the pre-meeting survey results. Emma?
So as Brian said, we're interested in creating these ad hoc advisory panels to help us with individual funded projects. And now that we have you here, we asked you how these should work, and we're interested in hearing from you about, you know, what members should be on it, how we should find them, what your role should be in how these ad hoc advisory panels should work. So I'm just going to go over these survey results to inform the discussion that we're going to have today. So the first question on the survey was, what type of assistance do you think the ad hoc panels should provide? So I categorized them in three parts. So we have specific rare disease expertise. So the ad hoc advisory panels could help as they would have expertise with specific rare diseases. And then we have pre-award and post-award. And you'll see in the next slide that all of you thought that the ad hoc advisory panel should have a role both pre-award and post-award. So pre-award, it could be a consultation during the advisory panel prioritization, like what happened today, and then merit review recommendations. And then post-award, it would be supporting the staff in ongoing rare disease research issues, developing methods, providing guidance based on sample size, known prevalence, incidence, also assisting researchers in accessing patients and raised research issues. So this will be in the recruitment phase, then helping disseminate findings and providing oversight for consistency of projects to completion.
And after the discussion with Jason today, we might want to modify this, as a matter of fact, in terms of the solicitations themselves.
The second question was, should the focus of this assistance be pre- or post-award? So it was 100%. And the examples of explanations you gave were that pre-award can provide insight to help improve the applications, include study design and topic review, and then post-award can help to sharpen applications to ensure success and guide ongoing study concerns. So we then asked you if we should form one ad hoc advisory panel per rare disease project, or should we group rare disease projects under a same ad hoc advisory panel. So 7 out of 9 of you responded that multiple studies should be grouped under one ad hoc advisory panel, and here were some options to group projects. So by subspecialties, research form, therapeutic areas, or also just on a case-by-case basis. So basically each time we would have a rare disease project or fund rare disease projects, we would decide whether we should group them together under an ad hoc advisory panel, or maybe a specific project would require an individual ad hoc advisory panel. And then the average of members that you were recommending should serve on these panels was 6. Then these questions were about how these panels should report back to you, how often they should. 4 of you thought it should be at each of your meetings. 1 of you thought it should be every 2 RDAP meetings, and then 2 of you thought it should just be once a year. And then the next question was about the content of the report. Pre-award, you said you wanted to see high level of grants considered and the results of review and the awards, and then the follow-up. And then post-award, you would want to know about the aim of the research, the type of assistance that was sought from the specific project, and then that would therefore help you develop best practices across all these ad hoc panels and what they've learned. And then finally, review or CR evaluation for rare diseases. And here are some other comments that were entered through the survey. So the first one is, the aim should be to have a few ad hoc panels to address shared issues in rare disease research. These panels should not be a barrier or burden to applicants and researchers, but an assistance. We should create a process that is consultative and supportive. And finally, we should continue to learn from the process and modify it as needed as we go.
Discussion. Any comments by any of you? Does it Did all this seem familiar? Oh, good.
So has there been a request for an ad hoc panel yet by one of the other groups? So you just want to make sure we're ready to go. Okay. How many of you would be willing to serve on an ad hoc panel?
What we need is trials. Mm-hmm. Successful applications.
This is Mark Skinner. A little bit just curious about the administrative support cost logistics. I mean, I could see this sort of spiraling out of control. And so I don't know what PCORI has in terms of resourcing them, because I think, you know, creating panels with expectations is going to create its own set of downstream problems. So does PCORI have the capacity to do this? And if we're successful, it's sort of beware of what you ask for. If we get a lot of, if we're successful in generating a lot of rare disease applications, and then I guess there's an assessment, do they get an ad hoc panel or require one? And then do we have the capacity to manage that and meet that expectation? I'm just sort of wondering what our bandwidth is.
I'm going to turn to Emma in a minute, but the short answer is absolutely. I mean, we clearly have the funding. We have quite a process in place right now in terms of managing and leading the research efforts that we are funding now. We've got a lot of projects out there, and we're just now getting seriously into pragmatic studies, and so we will be learning about the whole process of providing technical methodological support on a trial by trial basis going forward. We have an entire not only methodology committee to guide us at least generically in this area, but we have a methods program of staff, methodologists and program officers in our methods group that we can lean on and that we should take. It's in a big respect to the methodology and in a very short order, we put together this consultation process post-merit review of this cycle that just is concluding literally right now. That's worked very, very well. So the answer is we absolutely do. We also, as we noted earlier, or I noted earlier, that we do not foresee these panels working with the investigators. They're really consultative to our staff, and it's the we have very professional program officers that are all analytically and trained. So they'll be carrying out the actual work. I would imagine almost all of the actual efforts will be virtual meetings and evaluation of protocols and research designs and progress reports and so forth. I don't see that that's going to be a problem. I mean, it'll be a challenge. There's no question about it. But by the time we have rare disease trials ready to be, ready to have subcommittees being involved, we'll have quite a bit of experience. Anything else I missed?
No, the only other thing I would add is that we're also interested to hear from you whether you think, you know, all funded projects should have assistance from rare disease experts, or whether we should put in place some sort of process by which our program staff could call on an ad hoc advisory panel only if needed.
And just one other thing, and I'll write to you, Cindy, in a minute. I can foresee, based on your interface with the clinical trial advisory panel, and particularly with Jason here today, that these committees could work with the clinical trial advisory panel and on methods consultation in terms of methodological issues associated with rare disease trials.
I'm not sure the answer to Emma's question is the same pre-award and post-award. So post-award, I could see how the team would say we need help here and things are winnowed. I mean, if we're dealing with a couple hundred coming in the pre-award category, I think it becomes much more cumbersome. Somebody's going to have to triage, but that's where we're losing the applications that aren't making it through, so that's where the ad hoc committee support might be the most valuable. So somebody's going to have to make that decision. And there's a process now who's advancing. They don't advance because they're failing in some particular area and ad hoc consultation would improve it, or are they failing just because it's not relevant to the grant request that's out there? So it seems to me the pre-award piece is the much harder piece to define when it's needed and when appropriate.
Yeah.
And how early an ad hoc committee could be engaged.
I don't think we're envisioning, I'll probably turn to Kara as well here, but I don't think we're envisioning getting involved in the raw applications. The applications, first of all, we go through an LOI process now so that we weed out a lot of the potential applications if they don't sort of fit molds that we're that we solicit. Secondly, when the applications come in, they go through a process to determine whether, in fact, they're really eligible to be reviewed by the merit review process. And then they go through the merit review process itself and are scored based on a criteria, which is pretty basic. And we've discussed that earlier this morning, I think. And in terms of being patient-centered and impactful and da-da-da, all that sort of stuff. I think it's after that, before they're actually awarded, is when we're talking about pre-award. Isn't that correct? So it's not the large group of many of which are ineligible for award. It is those that are narrowed down that are eligible for award that we want to review and make sure that they're set up in a way that they'd be successful. Kara, go ahead.
Yeah, just to add to that, I mean, we really are thinking at this point there are separate functions that we need to think about distinctly. One is what happens when we're selecting applications and the review, which we, as Brian said, we talked about earlier. But the post-award management is really important because all we have when the projects come to us is an application. And we require as part of our contracting milestones that we review things like, are the milestones appropriate? Are they planning a recruitment plan that's realistic and achievable? Are we providing a midpoint review where we have a chance to review the study protocol and agree that the methods are appropriate before they start recruiting the first patient? So there are multiple time points that I could see an ad hoc panel weighing in. You know, it might just be once before the study protocol is out the door and they're executing their plan. But it may also come up that they're having trouble recruiting and we need to reconsider and work with them to think about the design issues and how we could adjust, 2 years into the project. And so I think all the recommendations were really valuable. You know, thinking about the administrative portion is tricky because we don't know how intensive this process will be for some very large awards, like in our pragmatic studies where these are $10 million awards and multi-sites. And, you know, we may really need a panel that's almost a standing panel and a very, you know, starts with this panel but then recruits people who have specialized expertise to help guide that proposal, maybe even ask members of the CTAP or the methodology committee to help make sure that things are moving along in the right way. So I hope that's also helpful to guide us on where to go next.
I think we actually had our first request for an ad hoc panel today. in the last meeting for the question around this, and actually we should go ahead and probably, well, that's what they said. I mean, Stanley actually said he wants to be the facilitator on it. So one of the things we probably need to do is identify probably no more than four from this group. You know, if you look at optimal group dynamics around decision, it's usually less than six for that, and they'll probably want two or three from theirs. But one of the things that would be useful is if you are interested in participating in that, if you could actually send Emma a message or just let her know you're interested in that, and then we'll put together a group on that that can feed back to the larger group, so, but I think gives us a working group to go forward on that. So it sounds like they're interested in actually doing a fairly major question, and I don't want us to let any moss gather on that process if we can avoid it.
Plan to develop a way to let you know when this opportunity presents itself. We have projects already in the portfolio that we can bring to the panel and start creating some subcommittees and an agenda that is appropriate. So I think if you are interested, please let us know, and then we'll start figuring out the operational plan.
Would an applicant ever know that this was going on in the background, or is this all sort of internal to PCORI? What is the communication?
We don't do much of anything without letting everybody know. I mean, by your asking the question, someone knows. We don't know who that person or people are, but at the moment. But no, everything will be sunshine is the order of the day here.
Does PCORI have a skills matrix for this panel? So that, in other words, you know us, you know us, you know us reasonably well. But if another PCORI group is looking for, we need someone with this skill set, do you have a resources matrix for us? We should do that.
We have your phone number, which is helpful. But, yeah, we can put that together. That's a good point. And you should be all thinking about others outside who you know, who are your colleagues around the country that have special expertise, not only with respect to the diseases of the issue, as well as the methodological issues. Yaffa has a comment.
Yeah, I just have a comment. I want really to thank you for giving us the opportunity to be participating in a meeting with the assessment extension group, because it helps us in a better way, because we have to know where they're coming from. For me, it was eye-opening. Mm-hmm. And so I know where the emphasis has to be on my part, and I think that if we meet with the other groups, it will be very helpful.
Well, you're most welcome. I found it fascinating myself, and I think they did. I think this was very important for them as well. You could really, I think, feel that. And I mentioned in my remarks earlier this morning that when I mentioned to that panel that you wanted to meet with them, their heads picked up and they, you know, very enthusiastically said that they would like that. So I think it made a big difference. I think it's it'll make a difference going forward.
I would also make the observation that the folks in their committee last night, who may have been what I would say, I won't say negative, but maybe the most skeptical about rare disease and PCORI, the folks that actually have interacted with us the heaviest today. So I think we've sown, if nothing else, we have sown some seeds for thought.
So for those of you who are listening on the phone, we're now taking a break and we'll be back at 3:30.
All right, I am bringing you back to order. And now I'm going to turn it back over to Brian.
Okay, so we're going into the home stretch here. You recall that this is just an update about the collaboration with the Clinical Trial Advisory Panel So you know some of this already, but I just want to let you know where we're doing. You remember that we had that really, I think, useful dinner and informal discussion with the panel, and you talked about the issue of lack of data and the simulation, the decision of simulation. I can't even remember what that is. What is that? Remember? Decision on simulation analysis. Focus on most important outcomes, ways of improving patient engagement. Pardon? Oh, that's probably the simulation that Jason talked about. Yeah. Well, no, that's the next one here. But anyway, we did have an interesting meeting and a clear interest by the panel in working together with you. There was no question about it. It wasn't just Jason. That there is an opportunity for collaboration with CTAP in terms of the subcommittee on recruitment, accrual, and retention. This is a very active and very interesting subcommittee that they put together. It's going to be important in the conduct of our trials, and there's an opportunity for someone from here to be part of that trial if you're interested in recruitment, accrual, and retention, which I know is an important issue with all trials, but specific to rare diseases. And you can see what the commitment would be. We can come back to this to see if there's any interest in individuals here. I wanted to mention the joint committees and the ad hoc advisory panels we just talked about in terms of technical assistance to rare disease clinical trials. I think the discussion we had with Jason blends into this, as well as just plain moving forward on methodological issues. That we are working with CTAP to produce guidance on performing rare disease research once this landscape review is, yes, Naomi?
And the methodology committee?
Oh, and the methodology committee. Yep. Good. Thank you. That's why you're here. So you asked about, we talked a long time ago, probably the first meeting, I think, about getting going on a landscape review in this area. Of rare diseases, and this is the scope of work here, the rare disease registry standards and guidance, minimal data sets and data standards, the biospecimen standards and guidance and so forth. This, I'm happy to say, where's the information on this? This is a contract that's being negotiated right now. We have identified the contractor, and we will know and be able to share that with you as soon as it is consummated. It should be consummated. Should be consummated by now, actually, but it's certainly just taken a little bit longer than we wish it would. But this landscape review is going to be done. I don't have the precise time frame of this work at hand, but we'll let you know as soon as the contract's been negotiated. Yes, Mark.
So they do this all independently, and then we'll have a chance to review it and say you might be missing this or other relationships, or what is our feedback is on the back end, and will they be only looking domestically, or will they be looking at the global pieces as well?
So we actually recommended that they create an advisory work group on which members of this panel can serve to help inform their research before they start it. And about the global nature of it, I can check on that and let you know.
Be just as simple as they develop a list of questions and just survey us, and we can point them in directions, and we may not all need to be on the advisory panel, but I would encourage the global piece, particularly in the rare disease space. And that's where I'm thinking they might miss things, because I don't know who your consultant is, but they might not be as connected internationally.
and this is Marshall, I think, frankly, actually, the composition of that, their advisory panel, we would want to help out with some input and probably some suggestions as well. Rather than them reaching and picking who they want of us, it might also be useful if we can suggest some folks that would be useful to them.
So that's pretty quick. I don't know if we have anything more to say in that regard.
No? You want to do a recap?
Sure.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So
next on the agenda is Suzanne Schrant, who's the Deputy Director of Patient Engagement, and she is going to talk about compensating patient partners in research, which I think was an issue that was discussed here earlier. Suzanne's in one of the other panel meetings right now. I'm not sure exactly what time she's planning on coming here, but what we'll do is we'll do the recap first and then wait for Suzanne.
Okay. Well, the recap should not take a whole lot of time, but a couple of action items that I think have kind of come up during the day. I thought, frankly, the joint meeting with the other group was illuminating. I think one of the things we'll need is sort of a work item from this for Emma. Sorry, Emma. Is if you, those of you who'd be interested in serving on the Form the Question group, would let Emma know that you're interested in doing that. I think if, unless there's an objection from the group, since I kind of was the one that proposed the question in the first half, I'd like to be on the Form the Question group. Does anyone have any, y'all okay with, I mean, I don't have a financial dog in the hunt, so I don't have a conflict for that, but since this is an issue that's kind of burning in my mind, I'd like to serve on that, and we'll get some other folks involved. Also, it sounds like we're going to need a group of volunteers for the RAR group. So those of you who do recruitment, recruitment, ascertainment, and retention?
Recruitment, accrual, and retention.
Accrual, okay. So we also need some volunteers for that, it sounds like. We might as well go ahead and just need one. Has anyone got a burning desire to be on that one? All right. There we go. All right, and it sounds like that we're going to probably want to think a little bit about the ad hoc. One thing that might be for the landscape review, one of the things that might be useful is if we could put out a call for people to suggest members of that advisory panel who we think would be useful, we can actually maybe even preemptively forward that to the contractor, folks we think might be useful from that standpoint, including from our own committee as well. That doesn't mean necessarily they have to use it. I don't know how those contracts work. But if nothing else, it may kind of help with some of the expectations we have from that review. Other things today, I think.
Marshall?
Yes. So are you looking for disease-specific input, or are you looking for more generalist?
I'm thinking more methodologic types.
Okay.
Someone who's done probably studies across multiple rare diseases. Someone who's been involved in probably also approval processes at FDA or has done large-scale registry-type projects or also someone from the advocacy side who's worked across kind of the composition of those because there's also practical aspects of this as well. So a couple of different skill sets there I think we're going to need. Talking to Kara and Emma earlier, one of the things we're going to try to put together is a sort of skills matrix for the committee. That I think would be useful around these ad hoc committees. So we'll come up with a matrix. We'll try to fill in some from your CVs, but then would like you guys to fill in, too. So what things you have experience with, what kind of training you might bring. So, you know, who knows, we've got closet statisticians sitting around here, things like that that would be useful when it comes time to form ad hoc committees so we can kind of pull the skills we need from that sort of thing. Jason, wanted to thank you again for that talk. I thought it was excellent, at least, and very, very, it's kind of a neat way to kind of think about these things. I think going forward, we're going to want to revisit some of those issues.
Can I jump into that? I've got two things on my agenda that I'd like to talk to you about following up on. The second, actually, is Jason's presentation. And I'd like some thinking about how we could move forward with it. I could imagine this committee or this panel asking the Clinical Trials Advisory Panel to take up the issue of guidance or standards or something associated with clinical trial methods for rare diseases, for instance, or being very specific about your interest in the role of Bayesian adaptive approaches. Or the methodology committee, I'd like to ask Naomi how you would see this and any guidance you might have so that we sort of think about moving forward really aggressively if this group would like to. And I'm envisioning that could highly influence what PCORI then announces and the guidance it gives the field as to what its ideas are or it wants in terms of approaches to clinical trials in the rare disease field.
So I would suggest a course that the methodology committee has taken in developing standards, modified by the fact that we have a landscape paper in progress. Now, it will be interesting to see, as I recall, there are a lot of topics and a rather truncated time frame for that paper. Am I correct on that, or is that changed? So I would not be surprised if we will need more depth in the methods part. But we'll see what comes up with it. But what the methodology committee has done on kind of complex issues is the whole workshop to get a range of expertise and to get a good, expert discussion going of the issues, because I do believe it is very important to confront the problem of how you deal with uncertainty and make knowledge with small numbers and in conjunction with rare diseases and the clinical trials advisory panel. So that was my thinking.
Jason Conner. So along the lines of, discussing with the methodology committee and such, I don't know how much of that is necessary, I think, for two reasons. PCORI has, this adaptive methods document, which, full disclosure, I was one of the writers of, and it's really good. But I think it provides great flexibility. That's why our group is happy we got it. I think the risk of having, methodologists say, this is okay and this is not, is what Naomi said earlier, is the idea that there's not, a way to do it. Or there's not, one size fits all that, that we run that risk, is that no one is going to think more about the right trial for a specific case than the person who's designing that and the person who, the statistician or the designer that gets to sit in the room with the clinical area experts and all that. So I think it's a challenge then for a methodology committee or someone writing guidelines to, outline what is and is not good prospectively. So I think that ideally, and this is risky, I guess, is to just give them the greatest amount of flexibility, but as the adaptive kind of guidance says, here is what, when you do one of these things, here is what we expect to see reported, and here are all the things you need to include. So I'm not sure that we need more methodological guidance on, good and bad, but as long as it's clear to potential grantees what they need to include, I think that's the key, and I think we're doing that.
That's sort of fine in general, but it seems to me that the point of your presentation was you've linked that technique to rare diseases and how it can be specifically useful in an area of where we have very few patients, and that link has not been made. The question is, do we want to make that link? Because I can't say by any means that that applicants will put two and two together to even consider it.
That's fair. And I guess I agree with that. And I don't know if we need the methodology committee to put it together versus, I guess, if when there's a request for proposals or something to convey. Somehow, I'm not sure what the right language is, that, just to encourage innovative methods or somehow have language that they will be appropriately reviewed. Or, you know, so that way people feel that they have some flexibility there. And granted, that's hard to convey, I guess, that someone really feels the ability to do something innovative versus something that they can cite in a journal already. I mean, most trials I design, I can't go and cite a methodology for because we're sort of inventing the methodology as we go, and that's a struggle for some people. But I think we just need to be able to encourage that, and the adaptive guidance that PCORI has structures ways that you can invent them as you go as long as you're reporting all the right things.
Just to clarify the kind of the role and the way I have seen the methodology committee approach problems, one of the imperatives is to keep a floor on research, but to all floor on standards and methods. But another has been to be cautious to correctly identify areas where actually, you know, it's frontier and nobody knows exactly what to do. So I don't think you should be quite as concerned that there will be a set of rules by a bunch of statisticians that will confine innovation in this area. I also think that there is an organizational mandate that when there is funding, it should be guided by methods that come from this methodology committee that's in the statute. And I think that there is actually a wealth of very creative people on that group that may actually help to promote more innovative areas. And I think we would lose an opportunity if we did not connect the methodology committee.
No, I agree with that. And I certainly didn't mean to convey that we shouldn't involve the methodology committee, because I think the people on there are definitely some of the most open-minded, innovative statisticians. Yeah.
Yeah. It's Marty. I had a question. So we just quickly touched upon the registry, the guidelines, just guidelines in general, and the landscape paper. And so one of the issues that we discussed early on was that guidelines in rare disease doesn't fit the model, right, as far as the level of evidence. So couldn't we apply an adaptive sort of algorithm, sort of as Jason's doing, but make it for guidelines and what level of evidence? Because part of what we're trying to do is to create a more representative guideline based on the type of data that we have. And it would seem that you could use some form of adaptive rules, decision analysis type rules, to form those guidelines. So basically what came up was that, you know, we don't have large phase 3 randomized placebo-controlled trials. And sometimes in some of these rare diseases, you'll have only 10 patients. So how can you give it an alphabet soup grading? And that's what then led to the whole, what do we know about it globally and the landscape paper. And so I was trying, I don't know, in my head, I was kind of combining the innovative adaptive design statistics to guidelines and the kind of would then work its way into a methodology for trials, right? It all kind of links, and I just wasn't sure if anybody had ever thought to do that in, for guidelines instead of just for clinical trials. Does that make sense? I'm kind of thinking out of the box, but it would seem that, you know, you might have two small-scale trials with 20 patients that kind of like your ECMO study. It's not the best study, but it was enough to make you think this is working.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not fitting the model of a P equals 0.5 in your classic design. And so a lot of the trials that we have in rare disease aren't fitting the natural, or it doesn't meet the p-value because of the power.
Right.
So couldn't you use your modeling to then create a new way of doing guidelines?
So I'm not sure I understand the idea about modeling to do guidelines.
So what happens is that you'll have a lot of observational studies, and you'll have some fairly well-designed randomized studies, and you have just a sort of case series and a hodgepodge of data. And then in each individual rare diseases, you're coming up with standardized guidelines that are trying to fit within the model of standardized guidelines of level of evidence, whether it's expert opinion. You know, we have two randomized placebo controls. And so for rare diseases, it doesn't work well. And so what I'm proposing is that maybe you could come up with different probabilities of strength of evidence to then get a better guideline.
Yeah, I don't know. I think I'd have to think more about it.
Could I comment? So that was sort of what I was alluding to when we were talking about internationally, because there is a project that I'm thinking of that I wanted to make sure got into our literature search. So it's called the European it's funded by the European Union. It's about a four-year project. It's done under grade through McMaster University, and it's called RARE. And it's actually taking the sort of the NIH-established guidelines process and adapting it where there is limited evidence to develop evidence-based guidelines. And that process is underway for about 3 years. I participated in one of the small focus groups of it, and it's being led by a team out of McMaster. I mean, it's multi-center, and I've seen some of the reports. They've published some on it. I don't know when it's finally an output, but I mean, hemophilia, just which is sort of my field, happened to be one of those that was piloted through one of the workshops, and they've had a series of meetings in Europe. So that was one of the things that I was thinking might be interesting, because that is a way to get evidence-based guidelines that would qualify for the National Guidelines Clearinghouse, which obviously is important to all of us for reimbursement and clinical practice and everything else, but adapting where there's limited evidence, and then doing it within all of the ethical disclosure frameworks and grading process. And I'm finding it quite a fascinating process. So, I mean, it's a little bit different than what he's talking about, but I mean, there is work being done on it, and it's being done, I think, through your, I think it's funded by the European Union or European Commission. I'm not sure which, but
If we could get that information, it might be worth having someone from, I mean, it's not that hard to get someone down here from McMaster to maybe come and present, because why reinvent the wheel if they've got a good system going forward?
Could you send us and Emma a link to this? Thank you.
So, well, sorry, go ahead.
I have one more you suggested I bring up at appropriate time. I don't know.
So I wasn't aware of that, the great RARE project in progress, but I will say my experience at ARC was there are like corollary criteria within grade that can be used to fit some of those circumstances of rare diseases. And I would also say that another way of going at this is to start to articulate levels of uncertainty that are tolerable in different circumstances of unmet medical need. And in fact, that's some of what the FDA is doing now. They now have a proposal for accelerated approval or draft guidance of devices under conditions of unmet medical need. Now, you might love it or you might hate it, but the real critical issue there is starting to really articulate the acceptable levels of uncertainty in certain contexts, and that's what I would like to aim for.
I love that verbiage. So I think I wasn't really understanding what you were saying. I'm not a guideline expert, and so my foundation was poor. But part of what I've heard was, is she asking that, is it okay to, like, grade on a curve because rare diseases have challenges? Evaluating evidence in rare diseases has challenges that evaluating evidence elsewhere doesn't have. So I think you hit the nail on the head saying, you know, this discussion of how much uncertainty we're, you know, willing to tolerate, because we realize we have to tolerate more, and in that case, you know, that's, you know, justification for higher type 1 errors or justification for making decisions when we might not otherwise be willing to make them. So I think that's very well put.
So at a break, we had a sidebar discussion relevant to recruitment and dissemination. And I requested, and Brian and volunteered, Emma, I think, to help with this. And what I would find very valuable is a very short 5-7 slides PowerPoint to just outline the items that we could use to explain to potential investigators the goal of the rare disorders. And this really came to my mind just before this meeting because the American Academy of Pediatrics is having a subspecialist summit. And one of the requests of the board subspecialists was that we help them as an academy enhance their study of rare disorders. And I thought, oh, my goodness, what are we, where are you? Why don't you know about this? But these are board-certified subspecialists. So that would be one group, and I have an opportunity to talk to them in March. There are two other groups that we're actively involved with. One is the Down Syndrome Connect, which is the NIH registry for Down syndrome that I think presents some specialized issues relevant to this in terms of how does a investigator, perhaps an academic or maybe not, maybe just a hospital setting providing clinical care, initiating multi-center site study relevant to a very important, potentially very important clinical question. And how do we expedite that within the IRB traumas that we all encounter? So that would be another question I would like to be able to be sure to be able to respond to. And who's the go-to person, basically, is what we talked about. And then the third raises another issue by a third. I've participated in a international Pierre-Robin consortium in the Netherlands in October. And this was attended by 120 investigators, truly, from 24 countries regarding the initial Pierre-Robin. And to do anything effective, it's a very small group of patients, so you have to have multi-center groups, but it's really an international group. And I'd like to be able to go back to them, perhaps with this kind of information as well. I sat there that 2 days and thought, is the place to be able to help do this. So do we do things that might be international?
I would think we almost have to be international. It's rare disease. Can't avoid it. And Marilyn, no good deed goes unpunished. What I was going to ask is if you'd be willing to work with Emma to outline and pull together the supplies. You know what we need to say. Emma just got a lot of details from that. We can all use format. Something to have on, but would you work with them on that? Yeah, so I think actually having a visible entry point into the system required for rare disease would be useful too.
Absolutely. No, I think that's fantastic. And if we can do it in a rather quick way, that would be sooner rather than later.
All right. So this actually is a great segue into the next thing we need to talk about, which I think is probably one of the more important things. Y'all saw the graph earlier today where they showed how many topics around rare disease made it to the finals, and the number was zero. Well, we may have one contender today, and even with that, you can saw it's a bit of a lift. One of the things as a group we need to do is we need to, not only within ourselves, but we also need to be soliciting others. I think Marilyn's slide said it's helpful because it lays some groundwork, but we need to start generating topics. Brian very kindly said, you guys need to start doing this. I think it's a nice way of saying start doing your job. So I'll get start doing my job here. I know you weren't. But
my sense was that you need to guide us what we need to do. Obviously, the more help you can provide us in terms of identifying opportunities and so forth. Didn't we have a discussion last night, Kate, about rheumatology and the rheumatology community?
Yeah, a lot of the rheumatologic diseases are rare diseases. Not just pediatric, adult as well. It's all across the board. And
so we could be speaking at those conferences,
yeah,
for instance, and focusing on rare disease issues, for instance. Part of it is you can guide us. I mean, we've got a very large staff at this point. We're out a lot. We do speak to groups, specifically to potential investigator groups. A lot of them are clinical groups. So that is just one, but there may be a number of different forums that that you can sort of tee us up to go after.
So there is an.
You have to need to handle the mic. Your mic's not on.
I think that in Louisiana, in February, early February, there is a meeting, a rheumatological large meeting. Do you want to aim to them? Would be prepared somebody to.
Which meeting is this?
Rheumatological.
There is? Where?
In Louisiana.
In Vienna?
Louisiana.
Vienna. No, I don't. To be honest,
well,
I don't wish.
Send it to Vienna.
Well, send it to us, certainly.
Okay.
It's a little fast for some of us. But
I think the other thing that might be useful is if we have the, is there a way to sort of have, I hate to use the term, an online collector, but basically from the webpage for RDAP, a quick form where someone can fill in a topic idea, answer maybe two or three questions, which we can help generate so we can at least start collecting those. For instance, I'll be at the American College of Medical Genetics meeting in March. I'd love to have something where I can hand out things saying, here, go, you got an idea for cross-cutting rare disease research here, go enter this in, and we can start collecting some of these as well. Is that within PCORI's scope to have a little mini-entry form on our page that's easily accessible to the public? Well, there you go. So they've anticipated our wants and needs.
Do keep in mind that this is comparative effectiveness research. It's
right.
Not just everything in the world.
Well, no, and that's what I was going to suggest next. Could I have a volunteer to kind of, for the intake on that form, how to word it so that we can collect that, and it's not just like, well, I want to look at, you know, toenail fungus in Malaysia or something like that. I don't, but something instead where it's actually a comparative question. Who wants to volunteer to help out with that? Just,
wait, do you mean,
is already there?
Well, the guide that is in your packet is, you know, helps people formulate the CR question, yeah.
So for the actual entry of what they're going to enter in on that, for the web capture, you know, what is it going to do? Just collect the title of it and then a few ideas? Will there be a couple of questions or what's actually going to go in there?
If you give me 1 second, I'll tell you exactly what the questions are on the form.
Sounds good. So topics are going to be a big issue. And then finally, I have one request that's coming out of something going on the Hill. So currently underway, there's a bill that's under construction to look at doing a national reliance agreement network for IRBs. This actually is in addressing some of the questions we've been talking about. It would be the way it would basically be structured is mandatory participation in an IRB reliance network if you receive federal biomedical research funds. It dovetails nicely with some of the NIH's desires around central IRB, but also allows outside IRBs to participate as well. The carrot, so to speak, of this is that it de-risks the local institutions for the quality or nature of that IRB that they accept from elsewhere. So once the text is ready on that, are members of this committee as an RDAP willing to at least take a look at that and give input? Okay, good.
So the question on the form are, is your research question related to a specific disease or condition, and one of the options is rare disease? And then it asks, what is your research question? Why is this question important to you? Does your research question address any of PCORI's priority populations? And then they're listed. If applicable, which study designs would best address your research question? And you can select all that apply. Which stakeholder group do you represent? And that's it.
Yeah, I think that, and this might be something staff could do, to do a search of Yahoo, Facebook, Google patient groups for rare diseases and post that on the patient groups. And then also be sure in that form, a lot of patients don't have any idea what methodology means. So make that an optional, or I don't know, because I think, you know, patients don't even know we exist. And where you want to find these patients and where they are is in these groups. And there's literally hundreds of them.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's also a link to the...
Yes, that's linked from the submission page.
Okay.
And the question about study designs is not required, Kate. It's just an option.
But also just put not required. I mean, I haven't seen it, but you want to take down all the barriers you can.
Right.
Part of what recruitment means.
So I think we're done with our wrap-up. Anybody else have any?
Yeah.
Naomi.
Well, I'd like to suggest a programmatic/staffing scheme for really going at this issue of robust pipeline, and that would be to have a designated individual from the engagement staff whose job was to solicit rare diseases proposal. Carol and I were talking about this at one of the breaks, and she mentioned maybe that person should be co-teamed with somebody from the science staff. And then another feature of this programmatically would be matching up patient questions with investigators who would be willing to be flexible about what field in rare disease research that they worked in. And maybe there's some incentive you could offer, just the way FDA offers certain incentives for coming up with orphan drugs. So I just wanted to make a programmatic suggestion.
Well, that's a pretty good segue into introducing Suzanne Trant, who's the Deputy Director for Patient Engagement. Maybe if you have time, you can address that after you go through your presentation. Suzanne is going to talk to us about compensating patient partners in research, which is an issue that was raised, I think, last time we met.
Great. Thank you, and good afternoon, everyone. As Brian said, I'm the Deputy Director of Patient Engagement, and the topic of compensating patient partners is something that we talk about frequently. Our advisory panel on patient engagement is actually meeting simultaneously today and tomorrow with the same time you all are, and they are articulating a PCORI framework on compensation. We're actually going to discuss it tomorrow, so I can't share that with you today, but know that it's coming. So what I'm going to do is walk you through sort of the activity to date. There actually has been a fair amount of work on this topic. I've been with PCORI for just 2 years, which actually in PCORI time is a long time. And as soon as we started funding, this was one of those questions we received constantly. So we felt that it was important to provide some semblance of guidance. And so I'm going to walk you through a couple of the pieces of guidance that we've provided, and then hopefully have a discussion about some of your thoughts. I know this has been a topic you've all thought a tremendous amount about. So these are just the activities I'm going to walk you through in more detail. So I'll just go ahead and advance. Are any of you familiar with our engagement rubric? Is that a familiar term? So this is a tool we developed, again, in response to just so many questions from our applicant communities, not only about compensation, but about patient engagement in general. What does this look like? How do we do it in our proposals? And compensation was certainly one of the things we received so many questions about. So we didn't want to be overly prescriptive. We don't know that we hold all of the right answers to patient engagement at this point. We're building that evidence base right now with this portfolio. And so the same is true for compensation. The way we built this rubric was actually to take examples of engagement from promising practices from our portfolio for our first three funded cycles and just packaged it into a tool that we could then provide to our applicants. And compensation fell very logically into this tool because it's something that comes up so frequently. You can see the way the rubric is organized, there's different components. It goes along the chronological order of study conduct, from planning to conduct to disseminating study findings. That fourth category that we call the engagement principles is more of a sort of a catch-all. These are those really pressing issues that don't fit neatly into a chronological portion of research. They span the whole continuum, and compensation certainly fits there in that fourth category. So these are the six engagement principles that we articulate in this portion of the rubric, and the one to really hone in on is partnership. This is where we dropped compensation in, because we really felt like if you're truly going to honor the notion of partnership, if these are really patient partners, and just a small sidebar here, We are not talking about compensation of subjects. That's a whole different legal element that goes to IRB approval and all sorts of other things that we're not going to discuss. This is really about involvement of patients on your research team as meaningful, engaged partners in design and conduct of the work. So this is about how do we honor those people on our team who that's the expertise they lend is as a patient, not from the science world, not necessarily from clinician groups or other important stakeholder groups, but from that patient perspective. And doesn't it speak somewhat to equity and value if everyone else on the research team is being compensated for their time, even if that means some sort of in-kind contribution from your employer, and then the patient partners are volunteering time? And we really felt that that spoke volumes about how we view the input of patients. And so we really wanted to lay this out as cleanly as we could. Certainly at the beginning and even now, I don't think we're at a place where we can require necessarily compensation, but we're certainly strongly encouraging it. So this is how we describe it, that we really want to see that demonstration that you're valuing time and contributions of patient partners. We also talk about just reasonable and thoughtful time commitment requests. So it's not only about the financial compensation. It's about are you conducting this in a respectful way and maybe amending schedules so that patients can really fit this into their normal lives. And then we've got these are not very specific examples. In the remainder of the rubric, we actually have very specific examples from different engagement practices. Here, we were very careful. We didn't want to necessarily provide examples that had dollar amounts because we weren't holding out a dollar amount or an hourly rate, again, as the right thing to do. We don't have a right rate for patient involvement, but we just pulled out a couple examples from our rubric that are very sort of broad. Another source of guidance for not only our applicant communities, but actually our patient communities that want to know more about PCORI and what we fund. This is in our applicant FAQs that lives on our website. So we actually reference the engagement rubric here, but we go into a little more detail down below, essentially saying, you know, each project is different. How you want or need to compensate your patient partners might vary, but it's certainly not silent. We've not been silent on the question of compensating patient partners because we know it's an important thing, and it's something that we hear from our patient communities loud and clear. And then actually in the application materials themselves, so in our funding announcements, in our application guidelines, here it's very specific information. This is actually about how you're building it into your budget. And you can see that you could either build patients or stakeholder partners in if they are employees and how you would handle that. If they're not employees, might they serve as consultants? And I'll move in a few minutes into some other scenarios that we've encountered where you've had the applicants or awardees have had to be very creative about providing compensation because it can be quite challenging depending on sort of the bureaucracy that you operate in. So this is sort of one of our great sources right now of information. This is, in addition to the engagement rubric, another kind of brand new concept we came up with is called the engagement officer. And these are people who, just like a program officer, is tasked with monitoring oversight of a project. You are making sure milestones are met, that deliverables are provided. The engagement officer oversees engagement in a project, and so compensation would fall under this ambit of the engagement officer. These engagement officers are assigned across our portfolio, so they're managing projects. They're on the kickoff calls with the rest of the science team who manages the project. They're even involved in milestone negotiation and certainly in other conversations. Compensation comes up quite a bit. And we, as engagement officers, these engagement officers don't only talk to the PI. They talk to patient and stakeholder partners on the team as well. And so as you can imagine, compensation can be a ripe conversation. Certainly early in the life of a project, one of the biggest difficulties is figuring out the mechanism to pay. Even though these are not human subjects, sometimes IRBs get a little bit nervous about anything that looks like you're paying a patient, and so that can really, we see IRB approval delayed because of these issues. We also just have other sort of legalistic issues with, is it an employee, is it not an employee, might you provide a stipend instead of a consultant fee? There's really many, many permutations of how this can look. One of the things that we're very excited about, although it hasn't come to fruition yet, is
part of the task of these engagement officers is actually pulling all of this learning, all of these examples together into some sort of repository that we can actually then provide back, either share it across our portfolio so that people having challenges can see, well, here's a menu of options you could use if you're having trouble providing compensation, but also to provide externally, because we also see other research funders looking to us for guidance. This is sort of a new world where we're paying patient partners to be involved in this way, so we want to be thoughtful and mindful and try to provide guidance where we can.
Can I ask a question?
Oh, sure.
Is compensation is the right word?
I was just at another panel having this conversation about compensation. I mean, we are talking about financial compensation primarily, but we do get questions about incentives and, does travel reimbursement count? Is that enough? Or do you actually want to pay for time? And I think that's what would be a great conversation to have. I think when we're thinking about the notion of equity, and when I say we, I mean sort of our engagement team, and when we're thinking about this, it really is about the time and the expertise of these patients. And I would take it back to if you look around the table on this research team, and everyone is getting financial compensation in some manner except for the patients, what does that say? Or, to take it a step further, a slightly different path, it also enables participation from people that may otherwise not be able to participate. So if you look at some of the work I've been involved with, the people who are able to participate without compensation might be a very sort of out of one demographic, and you keep getting that voice over and over again, whereas people who aren't able to participate, they need to miss work, they need childcare, they need transportation. It's really a facilitator to get a diversity of perspectives in the room. But I'd be interested, what is your thought about the word?
It's because the terminology is so ingrained when you recruit patient for clinical trials, either through ads, through the TV or the paper, you'll get, you recruit patients to provide blood and you pay them. So I think the connection that people make is that, the IRBs and the ethical group regulation is really very harsh. When you can compensate, when you can pay, and then, So I'm wondering if this just too close.
Yeah. What terms would work? How would you frame it if we were going to change it? What would it be?
Incentive? To me, it's, but I, I'm sure that there will be other.
No, okay.
Not to disagree with the author, but I think if you're going to create equity in the room, then you need to have equity of terminology. So if you're earning a salary, you're getting paid as a scientist or clinician to sit at that table, then I'm getting paid a salary or an honorarium, but I'm getting paid the same thing. If you put me in a different class, it creates tiers and levels in the room. And the goal really is I think, also to create intellectual equity, and you are an equal partner at the table. Now, as a patient, the doctor may be getting $450 an hour, and I may be getting $150 an hour. That's a whole different equity issue, but we're both getting paid, and maybe we're getting paid for what we're bringing to the table.
So would you consider?
And Kate, you must speak.
Yeah, I just add one other thing, and that is that with rare diseases, I think you're going to find an additional complication, and that is that there's so few of us that we are very used to being compensated for everything. I mean, I've seen large discussions on the listserv, at least for my disease and at least on one other disease, of how much is enough for us to fill out a survey. And it's because, no, and this is because there's a history behind that of any time there's a new drug or they want us to look at their advertisements or whatever. And I don't think that's true in probably the more general population, but there is that's an added complication with rare diseases.
I want to modify that a little bit, though, because there are some areas in rare disease where the patients don't expect any compensation, mainly because sometimes there is no drug, there is no money in that particular area, and the patients
view sort of the benefit of just having the studies going on is enough coming back there. So I know Gaucher's is a unique exception to that because there is a lot of money in that field.
Yeah.
The other thing, though, I'd bring up, too, though, is oftentimes your consultants or your patient participants are also going to be your study participants as well because there are so few. And that's one thing to think through is someone designing a study that they're then going to be a participant in and is compensated. How does that kind of work out?
Marshall is saying, are you going to pay the same for scientists that happen to be also a patient?
We have some around the table here, as you may know.
Or anybody that's holding a position in, do you want to treat them the same manner?
I truly understand. I am a patient with a rheumatologic disease, and I'm a lawyer, so I'm in this crowd. I get it. These are really hard questions. I think I'm going to work backward a little bit. The issue you raised about the duality, that's actually a whole different working group that we are working on in engagement because we also, apart from compensation, we're also worried about several things, a little bit of human subjects issue and sort of are you a person that's a subject or are you a person that's a participant and does it need to be in a continuum time-wise? Are you separated from... Anyway, but I hadn't even looped compensation into that, and that's true because then you really get into coercion and other issues that are very significant. I think the notion that some patients have been exposed to a lot of compensation and others have been exposed to no compensation really came into fruition. We had a gathering of all of our pilot project awardees. We actually had a small working group that just talked about compensation. We weren't tasked with developing a policy, but we had a really rich conversation, and I think it's something that eventually we will tackle in whatever policy we statement we put forward. But the question is, if you allow patients to opt out, so kind of could you have a policy that allowed patients to decline an honorarium and still capture the spirit of compensating patients, if that question makes sense. If you allow them to opt out, then does that actually take away from the principle of providing compensation? Does that make sense?
Yeah. One of the things that at least has been done sometimes is patients can receive the honorarium themselves if they designate the organization to which it goes. And that maintains equity and that, at least
yeah.
From the patient's point of view, seems to be something that's been pretty
I've
acceptable.
Used that model before, and it was very popular with the patients.
Well, it is, I've been in that situation, but for me it was a board-dictated policy that I couldn't take compensation, and I didn't want to give up money for my organization, but it can create an odd peer dynamic with the patients that are being asked to participate, and I've seen that as well, because they're seeing their colleagues who maybe aren't volunteering or in a relationship with the organization, taking the money. There's nothing easy about this. And the reality is that somebody's making money off of this somewhere down the end of the road, and patients are getting more savvy. But I worry that this destroys the incentive for patients to volunteer and participate in research. I mean, it's a messy spiral.
Possible to avoid money involved and the compensation, whatever terminology you want to use, will be in training or in participating in a workshop or in a meeting, but not really giving them,
No. You know, if I'm sitting on a BCORI meeting, or if I'm going to an engagement meeting, or I'm representing you at the American College of Rheumatology as a patient, I have the expertise that I don't want a little more training. I'm sorry. I'm being very, very honest. Now, some patients may accept that, but I think patients, if they're really going to be research partners, as far as equity is concerned, need to be considered, whatever that compensation is, and it's not kind of in lieu of or we'll pat you on the head because you're a nice patient.
Let me just bring up one more point that kind of builds on top of this. Yeah, we've kind of tried to avoid this in studies I've done from the same reason as you have a limited patient pool, and if you have multiple people trying to do investigations in that field, you end up in a bidding war for patients, and that gets ugly very quickly.
I think studies are a little bit different than advisors. I think study subjects, there's more or less protocols for study subjects based on how much bother it is or whatever. I think that's a little bit different than being asked to be on advisory committees to projects, working with investigators. I see that as two separate things.
Were you speaking to subjects or to partners on a study team?
Some of both, actually, because I've seen, one where that gets into, like mm-hmm. I said, a little bit, and actually can get faster into a bidding war if it's someone with a particular expertise.
Sometimes when, as a physician, when you're asked to be on different advisory boards, they have sort of a market rate. So I was just thinking that you just have a flat, some patient rate that's of market value. I don't think you can go into some patients are lawyers and some patients are scientists, but with equipoise, right? You need some standard rate, I think.
I assume you have more to. Are you finished with your?
The very last, and this is just a teaser, but we did, as I said, this compensation topic has come up so much, and now you've given us even more. I can't wait to report this to the patient engagement advisory panel. The notion of a limited patient pool changes the landscape again, so this is really critical to, I'm glad I was able to speak with you all. So we formed a subcommittee on compensation, and we've drafted this just framework, and it doesn't give dollar amounts, hourly rates, there's nothing like that. It's more just kind of capturing in a little more detail the spirit of equity and how compensation or whatever word we want to use plays into that. So that is forthcoming. But, you've all raised a lot of really great questions. That's
Would it be possible sort of pre-publication or going live for you to reach out to maybe even a few of the patient members on this panel and say, what's your experience and how would these rules, if they were implemented in rare disease, impact research in your field? Because I do think that we have some unique experiences.
Yeah. I'd go even further if you wanted to. I'd be happy, because Shays Community has a very robust and old listserv. If you wanted to, I bet that community would be happy to discuss this online and you could watch.
I might have
maybe without compensation, maybe with a little compensation. I that one I won't speak for.
I've given the impression that this is going to sort of come out and be published. This is really, it's been a process, and we're actually still, even though we're going to have something that's in draft form, we're still very early in the process. We'd have several layers left of review from all manner. We want a lot of input. Internally and externally, so yes to all of the above. I think those would all be great options.
Might I make a suggestion that you consider including an ad hoc member from this committee in your working group? I was thinking actually of Mark particularly, maybe, or one of the two of you. The other thing kind of finally I would suggest is logistics, not so much from rare disease. If you look at how, in other words, if the grant is to a university, trying to get a university to then disperse these funds to someone who's doing is an abysmally difficult, thankless, and task where you end up spending a multiple of what you actually are going to disperse to actually do this. Is there a way for PCORI to come up with a central mechanism so that for patient partners who are participating in PCORI-sponsored trials, the money is actually coming through PCORI for that? That actually also may remove some of the conflict between an investigator may also be the same person who is the treating physician for the patient partner as well as the person conducting a study that they may be participating in.
I think that goes back again to the function of these engagement officers that are really deployed project by project, and they can kind of gather, here's some best practices. I don't know offhand what PCORI could build to this question, but it's a great thought. We do have a funding mechanism completely separate from our regular science funding called the Pipeline to Proposals over on the engagement side, and these are very small dollar awards for sort of research preparation and research planning, and one of the things we do is require an allotment of funds to go to the patient or community partner out of the award amount. So even something sort of let me take that back to the panel and to the engagement team and think about kind of blending these ideas.
It makes it feasible rather than a nightmare headache.
Yeah, and I'm not quite sure. I'm not totally sure you captured. I think I know what Marshall's saying, and I'll try to give you an example. If you give me money to give to patients, every dollar is going to cost you about $1.90 by the time we're finished. If you pay the dollar, it's probably going to cost you $1.20. I mean, I'm adding some overhead or something. And so I think that's what you're talking about, partner.
Yeah, that and also a category doesn't exist in most universities for patient partners in study design. There's pretty good mechanisms for that in a disbursement
And the unions
model.
Will have a fit. Most places that are unionized, have you been here talking about unions?
We have not hit the union issue yet. We've hit the category. I mean, every call we're on, we hit a category. There's just a lot of complexity here. So this is all, nodding aggressively.
I've been using lots and lots and lots, I mean thousands of peers for many years, and one of the big problems is unions. So if you're in an organization that's unionized, bringing in these people just causes, that's just something you should add to your...
I've taken a lot of notes. Does anyone else have questions? I feel like I learned more than I shared, which is great for me. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Suzanne. As you can see, we have a complete handle on this. But actually, I think we actually have a fair handle on this. We've been in the business for a while, and so it's engagement people have really been front and center on the whole issue.
All right. Given that, I think it's time for us to wrap up this meeting. This is our third face-to-face meeting. Some progress, some things that we still, like the landscape reviews and things that we still have coming in. Very much appreciate our new neighbor. Anything you want to say, Brian?
Well, obviously, just thank you very much. I mean, this is terrific. Meeting today, last night as well. I was really pleased with what we all did, or you all did, and your representatives, Uday and Marshall, with the options panel. And Jason's, I still want to think through, you know, where we go from here, because you're talking to the choir, and the question is, how do we, you know, where do we go from there? You know, otherwise it doesn't go anywhere other than, you know, here. When is our next meeting? Emma's not here.
Yeah, Emma may have the dates, but it's planned for May. And but we may have a phone call in between to start planning the agenda with the full group. Okay, I'll make sure Emma distributes them. We're booking the hotel right now, so.
Yeah, that's correct, yeah. And the agenda isn't set yet, although obviously we're sort of setting agendas as we go along because of all the stuff that we're conjuring up. But if you have ideas about what you'd like to do, what you think we should do as a group, how often do we meet with you and Vincent?
About every
other month, yeah. So we have really good contact with Vincent and Marshall. And go ahead.
The email that we got about spaces on the panel didn't come up. As far as I know, people are applying. I think it's for patient representative. I think. Is that correct, Marshall?
Are you familiar? I know we are too, but.
No,
we're recruiting, I actually don't remember how many, but I think one of the things that we're really interested in for this panel, because it's so new, we usually extend the terms and then wait. So it's really a matter for this panel about whether we have needs that we haven't yet filled, because I think our charter does allow for us to add people. So if the panel thinks patient, we need
right?
additional expertise, we can do that for patients particularly.
All right, unless there's any other business, I'm adjourning the meeting. Thank you all very much.